Take our seats. Today is October 1st, 2018, and this is the sixth rendition of the expanded budget committee's presentations from the departments as to their budget proposals. We will hear again tonight from six different departments. Before we start, we're going to hear from our county administrator when he arrives. He's got a couple of things to brief us with. One thing I wanted to bring to everybody's attention is the last presentation tonight will be actually county administration's budget. And as part of that, Jason Molino will be discussing our capital projects and the capital budget. That's pretty important, and so I know we all get tired toward the end, but let's try to move this along, ask our questions, and also leave time so that we can get a thorough discussion of that. Can someone rouse Jason out for me? Here he comes, coffee in hand.
The food is too good.
Jason, you're welcome to take the floor to talk about the three things you wanted to brief us on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I will. If you look in your handout, that's not the right one. If you look in your handout, this sheet here, 2019 recommended levy growth with adjustments. So what we did here is we took into account what we're looking at for the increase in the homeless services costs related to the RFP with the homeless shelter. If you remember, that is going to be an additional cost out of the levy above and beyond what we recommended. It came in at about a little just under $305,000. So what I'll do is if you look up the screen here, I'll go with the cursor. Let me start with the left. Actually, let me start over. 2018 levy. The 2019 levy request, target request. The 2019 OTRs that were recommended, which were target OTRs, which are levy impacting. The combination of the both gives you a revised levy, and that is the increase of the proposed levy over 2018, which is a 1.43% increase over 2018's levy. In May, you adopted a 2.2% levy financial goal. So when we add in the $304,000 for the homeless services, and then we made two adjustments. Kevin reviewed the health insurance premiums. So last week, the consortium adopted a 5% increase in premium. We had budgeted a 6%, so there's a little decrease here. And then the percentage for pension was just a little bit lower than what we budgeted for, so it came in at about a $94,000 decrease, which then opened up, after you add that in and subtract those out, opened up a little additional capacity. So basically right now you are at a levy of about $809,000, which is at a 1.65% increase over the prior year, giving you about $271,000 remaining balance, so to speak, under your 2.2% financial goal. Does that make sense? It's on your sheet here. This is actually in gray because we consider it the gray area. And we have both the normal tax cap and then the Drydenized tax cap. we don't know which one's normal, but just to show you perspective, the tax cap with the town of Dryden's tax credits, it puts you at a 9.76% tax cap. Without it is a 4.78. Either way, you're well below whichever tax cap you want to look at, just to kind of show that, you know, in perspective where we are in relation to the tax cap. Well, what you do from there on is Rick. You all right?
You okay?
I'm getting sick.
So that was just to kind of give you an update. We took in homeless shelter. We took in decreases in health care costs and pension costs, and it gives you kind of a revised levy number, which is about 1.65%. Still good on well under the 2.2 financial goal. That's all from that. Two other quick updates. If you look at...
I just wanted to interject, as I do from time to time, that you mentioned the town of Dryden, and, of course, I've always said the town of Dryden is the crown jewel of Tompkins County.
Absolutely.
This shows it, so...
Absolutely. Both the east and the west side. So that's all I have on that. If you look at this, we did a revised OTR worksheet. There are several amendments, nothing significant, but just to show you, if you look on the top headings under the requested box, if you look on the far right-hand side, you'll see one-time requests and then in parentheses reserves. And next to it, target requests and parentheses levy. That is to delineate the one-time request versus the target. It's the same numbers. We just, I think, some folks were getting confused. We used the source of fund terminology, so we related it to more terminology that you might be more familiar with. Same thing over on recommended, one-time versus target. If you flip it over, you'll notice there are two, the school resource officer and the pilot project, removing barriers to access under the Tompkins County Public Library. They are marked with withdrawn. We did consult with Kathy. This will have to be amendments, even though they were withdrawn by the agencies. You will still have to go through an amendment process when you go to vote on changes in the budget because it was part of the recommended budget.
Where is that?
I'm sorry, if you flip it over on the other side of the paper, if you look down under the sheriff's office, the school resource officer, it would be OTR 58. It's striked out. It's got a line through it. Go down a little further, number 10, pilot project removing barriers under the Tompkins County Public Library. Also, and they're marked with withdrawn.
And because those were one-time requests, those don't change the levy?
They don't change the levy, and they have to be actually acted on by the legislature to change because it was a part of the recommended budget. They wouldn't, though, either way. Yep, correct. That's the last of it. The one last thing is nothing in front of you, but in the springtime, I had a conversation with Jennifer Tavares at the Chamber of Commerce about a potential small one-time OTR, as a $10,000 OTR. It was in support of a marketing initiative and really a website marketing initiative and as well as a community guide and project. It was really about revamping and making a stronger approach towards assisting employers and workforce with recruitment and retention. So it was a relocation guide, which involved a hard copy guide, some marketing, as well as a revised website with a series of resources for assisting employers with relocation and retention of their workforce. She had, there was a, because they're not an agency that presents regularly, there was a, essentially a failure in communication on my part to give her some deadlines. It kind of fell through the cracks as to when those, that request should have came in. So it has hence come in since then, just to give you a heads up. I believe, Martha, you are going to submit it at a future date. But it's a 10,000 one-time OTR. I would have recommended it in the budget had I had it in time. And it was my fault for not communicating with her on those timelines. But just to give you that heads up.
Thanks, Jason. And Jennifer and I and Jason have been communicating, and I've asked her to send, like, to email some information to everybody. And, yeah, Kevin, I would like to sort of just pop that in as an OTR. Thanks.
Yep. That's all I have, Mike.
All right. Good. Shall we proceed then? We have tonight our district attorney, Matt Van Houten. Welcome, Matt. Would you like to talk to us about your budget?
Sure. How do I get that up?
This is section 4, page 77. There are no over targets.
Thanks. Yes. Yep. I'll start off by saying I'm a Dryden High School graduate, just to remind everyone. So the good news is probably a couple of things. I was allocated 20 minutes and probably don't need that much time. Famous last words. But the better news
force
is
you.
Okay. The better news is that compared to last year, I'm not really asking for anything significant. So looking at the percentage, just some nominal overhead-related expenses that make it a 0.91% increase as far as what is being requested in for 2019. And as I noted at the bottom of the page, 95% personnel-related. We're pretty efficient, pretty bare-bones organization. It's really just about the people and not so much. We don't have a lot of other expenses. The expenses that we do have pretty much stay static from year to year and are pretty predictable. We have 13 and a half full-time, including 9 attorneys, and that's one more than last year. 4 administrative paralegal type positions, and 1.5 investigators. And the some of those, one of the administrative paralegal positions and some of one of the investigators is paid through the Stop DWI budget that I think Jason will be talking about
yes.
at the end of the evening. But we have 13 and a half employees. Kind of the overview, if you recall, during the past year, I had the resolution to reclassify some of the ADA positions that recognized that not everyone working as a prosecutor or assistant district attorney has the same level of experience. So I reclassified the positions of ADA into ADA 1, 2, 3, and 4. And that's significant for tonight's purposes because I have 2 ADA 3s on my staff, and in prior years, they would have had to be paid as ADA 4s, so that's about a $25,000, $26,000 savings in terms of the overall salary of the office because those are less experienced prosecutors. They're people that I hope will end up being ADA 4s, but they're not on the same level as the senior prosecutors in the office, so it gives them some incentive to work and to try cases and get that experience that will put them into that top tier. But it also creates a little bit of extra room in the budget that is it's always helpful. We had a couple of areas that increased. Our legal online legal research expense went up significantly because there's an additional attorney and we had to sign a new contract. Whenever you change the contract with one of those companies, they sell you extra things. And so it's not significant, but it's a little bit more. That's one of the increases. And other than that, there's really a couple of nominal increases. But for the most part, our overhead is pretty static. I did have a transition with the staff in 2018. I lost and a couple of experienced prosecutors. I replaced them with and finally have a full staff as of a few months ago with all 9 attorneys, including myself. So we're in a good place staffing-wise right now, but there was a transition. There was a period of time where we were short-staffed this year, and that is now, I think, some woods that we're through at this point. As far as the organizational structure, we have senior attorneys, we have junior attorneys, and we have one ADA 1, which is the local court ADA. That's what we added last year. That was the additional position. She primarily handles city court. She handles city treatment court, and she is working with me on the mental health court treatment initiative team. So we work on a vertical model in that we all handle serious cases, but we also handle local court cases and less serious cases. We don't have a big enough office to specialize as much as some of the bigger DA's offices across the state, but it provides for a good level of understanding of the whole process from top to bottom, including myself. I handle one of the town courts. I don't handle Lansing anymore. That was a busy court, but I do still handle Freeville Town Court. major influences on our budget, criminal justice trends. I'm knocking on wood right now that we have not had a homicide, and in 2018 there haven't been any major homicide cases. Again, knocking on wood. We have had a significant number of robbery cases, whether it's bank robbery or other armed robberies, drug crimes and sex offenses. So we've been in trial a lot, as we always are, and we'll continue. We have a lot of trials scheduled this fall. We are kind of at the mercy of what happens from day to day, and you know that dictates whether there's people working 75 hours in a week or 60 hours in a week. But everything is really, or most things go back to the opioid epidemic, and so many of the offenses, whether they're felonies, misdemeanors, can be traced to the heroin problem in our society, and we're very conscious of that. And to the extent that we can funnel people into a treatment court, and whether it's at the felony level or the misdemeanor level, we do that. And I've met with probation on a regular basis to figure out how we can maximize the people coming into the treatment courts as opposed to, you know, the traditional prosecution model. Alternatives to incarceration, I'll talk a little bit more about that as the focus of our office and our top priority, which I think reflects the values of our community. But we put a lot of emphasis on that. And having a full staff really with that ninth attorney allows us to dig a little deeper and to really understand the human beings who are involved in each case. Each case is different. We have a victim, we have an offender, we have their families, and we have the community that is all affected as they see and watch what is happening with the prosecution of cases. And what we want them to feel at the end of the day is that what happened was fair, and it really incorporated you know, all the information about the individuals that we can get into coming up with the right thing. So having that extra attorney has really helped, because we were not able to engage as fully in the Ithaca City Treatment Court last year as the judges wanted us to be, and as I wanted to be. We didn't have enough time. The attorney who was doing city court primarily just didn't have enough time, based on that caseload, to go to all the drug court meetings that he was being asked to go to. And now we're able to do that, so that's a really good thing, and we're seeing the benefits of that, I think, this year. I've been spending a lot of time in meetings on Raise the Age, which is now, today's October 1st. It's the first day of Raise the Age. I didn't get a phone call last night at 2 a.m., so that's a plus. I've been an attorney for children in my career for 20-plus years, so my understanding and background in the family court system is, I think, something that makes me really uniquely qualified to be the one. And so I'm going to take all those juvenile cases where someone is a 16-year-old charged with a felony case, and there's a decision that has to be made whether to prosecute it as an adult or to let it go to family court. So I'm hopeful that there won't be more than what we project to be, you know, 0 to 10 of those cases over the course of a year. Again, we can't predict. I'm shocked that we didn't get one on October 1st yet, but still, the day's not over. But there's a lot of unanswered questions about how that's going to be implemented, and some logistical questions that we're just going to have to figure out. But I've spent a lot of time with that group planning for Raise the Age, and now we're implementing stage one of it now, as well as the LEAD program, which everybody's heard of. We're not ready to launch that yet. From a law enforcement perspective, we've been ready to launch it for 12-plus months, and we're just kind of waiting for the rest of the program to catch up with us. This is an old slide, but it's still true. Public safety is my number one goal, and so everything that we do goes into that. But I think the fourth bullet is really important, that the more the community understands what we're doing and trusts what we're doing, and we're engaged with them and we're trying to do the right thing and listening to the community, I think that's really important to me. So it's on my slide. It's not just talk. It's important for us to walk the walk, too, and to be present. Again, this is another slide from last year, but it's still true. And doing the right thing is the most important thing from my perspective. So looking at helping people with opioid addiction and addressing the underlying cause of criminal behavior is a long-term solution that helps that person, that individual, break the trend of their own behavior. So we're willing to engage with those programs as much as we're able to, and that's our top priority. So we have right now, this is the list of the ATIs that we're engaged with. We have one ADA who handles felony treatment court. We have one in Ithaca City treatment court, and she's the new position, but she's going to every meeting and going to the trainings that are scheduled this coming year, and she's 100% on board. We have IDV court, Integrated Domestic Violence Court. It's a very difficult court in terms of domestic violence cases. Or violence cases are difficult to handle. They're very stressful. They're very emotional, and they take a lot of time to talk with victims and to advocate for them in the court system. But it's a court that allows for family court type cases and criminal cases to be heard in the same forum and in front of the same judge. So it's a really valuable tool that we have in the community to address those very difficult cases. Sex offender court, that's compliance court. So once someone has been adjudicated a sex offender, we try to monitor them to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. And we have an ADA who's assigned to that. Lead, as I mentioned, I've been going to, I don't even want to know how many hours of meetings I've been to. Rich is laughing, but he's been to all of them, too. We've sat across the room. There's a policy coordinating group and an operations working group that will be two separate groups, and they've met alternately. I've been going to most of both of those meetings, but I will have one of my assistants going to the operations group once it's really up and running, and I'll stick to the policy coordinating group, which is the higher level strategic group. Mental health court, I've been to a few meetings so far. We have a meeting tomorrow. Judge Miller is spearheading that initiative, and we hope that that will be up and running. It feels like it's going faster than LEAD. And so we'll have that up and running hopefully in early 2019, but spending some time working on that group, and that's a really good thing. And the last thing I put with an asterisk is Veterans Court. We don't have a big enough population of veterans in Tompkins County to have a Veterans Court, but I've met with the VA representative who was based in Syracuse, and I've also connected through the mental health court team with some other individuals who are organization that plans veterans courts. And so I've been talking about how we can, if we're not going to have a veterans court in a formal sense, at least recognize the resources that are available to veterans that we can use to help them. And sometimes that means that veteran gets a bed quicker than some people who are on the waiting list, and that opens up another bed for somebody who's not a veteran. So it's a good thing no matter how you look at it. But I put that in there because it is something important to me. And this is not a request or a pitch, but This is my staff of attorneys, myself, and one deputy, four ADA 4s, which are the senior, most experienced ADAs. I have two ADA 3s and one ADA 1, and I just put the last line there because we were at one prosecutor to every 13,125 people in the county, and the standard is you should have one per 10,000. And we're a lot better this year, and we felt the difference, and we appreciate that. So it's made a difference with us, and we're happy where we are now. We're not asking for anything else. So with that, I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Matt. Questions for Matt? Mike Sigler.
I just have two questions, Matt. All these different courts, I just from a philosophical standpoint, I guess, you're going to have the same judge, you have the same ADAs. I mean, why are we breaking out people into different courts like that?
Do you have something specific that you're thinking about? Or?
Well, I mean, I don't mean any disrespect to veterans, obviously, but I'm not sure why we're creating a court just for veterans. And mental health, okay, somebody commits a crime and they have mental health issues. Why are we sending them to a special court? Why wouldn't that just be handled in a regular court and say there are mitigating circumstances? I guess I'm not clear as to why we have so many different courts and why we're actually expanding the list of those. So.
Well, to the first question about veterans court, we're not actually establishing a veterans court. Some larger municipalities have them. We'll never have the veterans population to have one. But it's mainly just recognizing that there are some resources available to veterans that I'm aware of and am trying to figure out the best way to make them known to people in the criminal justice system so that we can get people help most quickly. As far as mental health court, for example, you're right. It's the same judge. It's Judge Miller. He's in city court. Judge Wallace is also in city court, and he handles the treatment, the city treatment court, the misdemeanor drug court. I think the difference in the reason why we want to have these specialty courts is because it's an opportunity to bring in more resources in a focused period of time. So if mental health court is one day a week, and you've got caseworkers and people from mental health that are there to help that individual break the cycle of their criminal behavior, and if it's because of a mental health diagnosis, you know, it's just if that person is going to a regular session of city court where there's 100 cases being called, and there's 2 minutes to address their case, they're just still in that cycle where they're not getting the individualized attention that can help break the cycle with them. And so to the extent that we can tailor those specialized sessions of the course that we have to focus in on, you know, people that have things in common or people that have common needs, that's the reason.
That sounds like logistics, too. I mean, that way you can get everybody. Okay,
yes.
That makes sense to me. Bail policy, you had mentioned that in here. Where do we stand with that now? Are we still setting bail for misdemeanors and things like that? Or, I know the governor was talking about it today. So
it does happen. So often I don't get asked for a bail recommendation on misdemeanors. And when I get a chance to talk to the town judges, I repeat my policy, which is that for misdemeanors, there should be a presumption of release on their own recognizance. There are some exceptions to that, sex offenses, domestic violence offenses, where there's a risk to a victim if it's a violent offense. But that's our policy. You know, it does, the implementation of that varies across the county because the judges are the ones who are making the bail decisions. Sometimes they ask us, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they ask us and they don't go with our recommendation. But our philosophy as an office is that we want individuals to be able to defend criminal cases when they're on the street, when they're with their families, when they're working at their jobs. You know, being in jail for even a couple of days can make somebody lose their job. You know, you've heard all this before. I'm now going down a tangent, but that's our policy, and You know, if it became law, as was proposed by Governor Cuomo, we would be happy with that. You know, there's always problems with proposed legislation, and we had some concerns. I had some concerns about how far that bail reform bill went, because it created some procedures that were really clunky, for lack of a better word. But I think we're moving in the right direction on that. And I won't be surprised if we see another bail reform bill soon.
Great. Thanks, Matt.
Other questions? I have Henry Granison.
Hey, Matt, can you explain what you'll be doing in mental health court?
Yes. Well, it hasn't been completely established. We're still working on the protocol. But the DA's office main role will be the screening process of identifying individuals who have diagnoses. And we want them to be people that could benefit from that level of help and those resources that will be in mental health court. But, you know, we have to focus on the victims. We have to focus on safety of the community. So, you know, if it's a violent offense or a sex offense similar to LEED, that person is not going to be eligible for mental health court. We have to look at some other way to address their needs but also protect the community. So a big focus of our role will be screening who gets in and then monitoring compliance, monitoring that they're doing what they're being asked to do.
Yeah, and I thought that mental health court was not a compliance court.
So it's going to be a different model in the sense that drug court is a sanction-based court. If you mess up, you get punished.
Right.
And you know what the punishments are from the beginning, and they're set out in your contract that you sign. Mental health court is going to be a more reward-based or positive reinforcement-based court, because we want the person to engage with the resources that we're helping them connect with. So it's going to be more of a, you know, you come to court and you get praised, and we, you know, we understand that you've done this, you've been to this appointment, you've stayed on your meds, and I'm just, you know, stereotyping, but that's the difference in the models. So we need to have a voice in the room to make sure that victims have that voice, and to make sure that the community is also being protected if the person is not being compliant with what they're being asked to do. So, you know, we're still figuring out how that's going to work. But it is a different, you know, process in terms than the drug court.
Also, in terms of the Veterans Court, who are you talking about for the resources? Are you talking about the victims? Are you talking about the alleged people? I mean, who are you talking about giving resources to?
Well, veterans have resources available to them, like through the VA, for example.
Right, but how does that work with the court system?
Well, it's there's not going to be a veterans court.
Right.
But there may be a bed open for a veteran tomorrow that someone who's not a veteran would have to wait a month for. So having a regular communication with the VA and with other, there's an organization, and I forget the name of it, but I got an email from a retired major general who was putting together drug courts across the country, and he wanted me to engage with his group. And I said, we probably have too small of a community to have a drug court. And he said, that's fine. We understand that. But we still want to, you know, communicate with you and work with you to make sure that we're connecting you with the resources that will benefit your veterans in your community.
Okay.
So the victims, you know, probably aren't veterans. But if they are, then they, you know, they might benefit from the same resources.
Right.
Let's go to Deborah Doss.
Sorry?
I said you thought this was going to be short.
Let's go to Deborah Dawson, please.
Thank you. Hi, Matt. Nice to see you. I was curious, as we move into the next year when we'll be considering legalization of marijuana at the state level, what impact that would have on your office. So I guess what I'm asking is, what percentage of your caseload arises from arrests for use of recreational marijuana?
That's a great question. Well, and for many reasons, but earlier this year, I actually met with all the police chiefs from the county law enforcement agencies, including state police, to talk about my feelings about the prosecution of marijuana offenses and personal use offenses as compared to entrepreneurial offenses. And the reality is that we don't prosecute unlawful possession of marijuana charges. And there's a practical reason why we don't do that, because we can't have them sent to the lab. The lab is too busy to test small amounts of marijuana. And so my pitch to them was, hey, why don't you rethink and tell your officers to rethink about whether they need to charge it at all, because it's not going to get prosecuted. We're not going to prosecute it. And there was a pretty lively conversation, but it was a productive one, and I think it was good. We made some progress, and you know, there are times when marijuana is part of the probable cause to conduct a further investigation, and it is still illegal, so you know, that's part of how officers investigate. But if you're only going to charge somebody with a ticket for unlawful possession of marijuana, I have discouraged the officers from writing that ticket, and it's not going to be prosecuted.
So legalization wouldn't have much of an impact on your caseload?
As you remind me that I didn't answer your question.
Well, we're trying to talk about his budget here tonight, not get into a major discussion about a policy issue.
Probably not.
Thank you. Martha Roberts.
Yeah, I understand, but it's sort of a budget issue, such as the two I'm about to ask. You said you're not asking for any other attorneys, because I assume you wouldn't have anywhere to put them, right?
That is true, although we were pretty creative with the office that our ninth attorney is in now. We basically created a shed out of a corner of the south end of our office. So we would figure it out, but it would be pretty difficult. We might have bunk offices.
All right. I haven't been over there recently, so I haven't seen the shed. But so is there any, maybe this is a Jason question, is there any plan to do anything with the DA's office?
One of the early discussions I've had with Matt is trying to, as we've talked about space needs downtown, is getting the county clerk out of the basement, then bringing the DA's office downstairs. It's an easy space to outfit. What goes hand in hand with that is improving the grand jury space, because the grand jury space is pretty tight and really not cooperative for their needs, which also might include also a side room as well. So I think what we've kind of talked about is, if we can get some momentum over the course of the next year to get the clerk out of that space, we would outfit the basement, move them downstairs, and also outfit a new grand jury room. If we can't make it happen quicker than that, it'll probably talk about moving forward with a grand jury room downstairs preemptively, because the clerk is the one department that has really reduced its space based on their digitization of their records.
We really need the grand jury room.
Yes, okay. I know.
All right, so. And then the other question is, we're hoping to ramp up our lobbying for a third county court judge, in part so that we, or maybe mostly so we can speed up the calendar. How will that affect your staffing?
Well, it's going to be a good thing, I think, if we end up getting the third judge. It will mean that we're doing more trials, which we want to do trials. That's how you give people their day in court. I think that's, you know, there's a guy who's going to trial October 15th, and he's been in jail since January 2nd. And he's been waiting for a judge to be available. We've had trials. It's not like we've been sitting around. But that gentleman will have had his trial long ago if we have the third judge. And the ADA3s that we have on staff, we want them to do trials. We want to do trials. That's how you get experience. So, you know, it will make us probably better as an organization. The more trials you do, the better you are at it. So there's many reasons why that would be a good thing. But for the community, it will provide a quicker access to justice.
Okay. We could probably use that kind of example when we go to the state. So, you know,
yeah, I'm happy to.
I'll be back to you for those. Okay. Thanks, Matt.
Shauna Black.
I was wondering, whenever Proposition 64 passed in California to legalize and decriminalize marijuana, there was an increase in traffic in the courts to expunge all previous records for possession. Would you assume that could be the case in Ithaca once we legalize?
I would think so. I don't think we have a lot of marijuana convictions that would need to be expunged, to be honest.
Okay.
It's not something that has ever been a real focus of our, you know, efforts.
Thank you.
Look at that. Plan
okay. Ahead. Matt, thank you very much. We appreciate your time tonight, and good luck in your department.
All right. Thank you.
Well, next up is our Recycling and Materials Management Department. Your big book, section 4, page 218, there are no over targets. Barbara Ekstrom.
Well, hello. So just real quick, before I go.
Pull the microphone closer.
Oh, sorry. Let's move. This one's better, actually. So before I go into my presentation, Jason did flag our budget in his briefing and basically explained that our situation from a money standpoint has not been the best this year and will continue to probably not be so. And the main reason for that, because we've had good years and not so good years. The main reason for that is because recycling revenues have plummeted, and we did just take on a new curbside collection contract last fall that amounted to about $500,000 more a year than what was previous. So when you look at that, you've potentially got a gap, barring anything else, of about $900,000. And so what does that mean? It means that either we have to eliminate programs, cut staff, or raise fees, or there's another area, which is we're fortunate that we will be getting some grant money from the from 3 years for recycling revenues, but that only fills the gap about $350,000. So Jason and I got to know each other very well during the budget process, and he's quite an intelligent and demanding guy. And at the end of the day, what I'm going to be presenting to you is our best effort to keep things as stable as we possibly can. I'm not expecting recycling revenues to really rebound for probably a year and a half to 2 years, and that's going to be when the processing capabilities expand in the United States. But I believe we have hit rock bottom. So with that, let me go to my first slide. So basically what we're looking at is expenditures and revenues that equal one another. You might recall, which is where the note comes in, we do have capital budget to balance for some additional expenses on the recycling and solid waste center construction improvements, as well as our big project, which is the tipping area building for food scraps, which commercial haulers will be able to begin using toward the latter part of this year.
So that net local really represents money that we're taking out of our savings account. We have about $2.7 million in there, which is far more than the required $640,000 that we need for our fund balance. So we have that situation. Now, we will be getting back around $350,000 probably sometime mid-next year once we finish our construction and we submit progress report payments, and that comes from the DEC grant. So that's just, it's about big money and moving money around, which luckily we have to spare. Full-time equivalents for us. The interesting thing about my budget is it differs pretty much entirely from the DA's budget. We, our staff and fringes only represent about 20% of my budget. And I'll show you a graph later for to just make sure you understand what we're paying for. This year, we just had a few extra hours reduced for one of our scale operators, and we're balancing that with another person in the office. So that's pretty much the size of that. I might also make mention that our overall budget is only going up by 2% net in spite of all of our difficulties, so long as the grant money comes in. I mentioned to you earlier about our new recycling collection contract. I will point out that even though we're paying $35 per household per year versus $24, what we used to pay, we're very unique in New York State and even in the country. There are very few counties that pay the efficient cost of recycling collection as a whole. So usually it comes directly from the hauler, like a trash bill. And right now, the going rate for recycling based on the dilemmas with the recycling markets is they're paying about $120 a year. And, you know, if it were a private hauler directly. And so that is very inexpensive, even though we're doing it. But we do have very high participation, and we have very efficient routes. I mentioned to you the operation of the food scrap tipping building. What does that do for us? It allows us to be able to help both the city and other haulers get into the food scrap collection business and not have to bring all this stuff up to Trumansburg to Cuba Compost. We believe that it will really help us to become successful in diverting at a low cost. What else is exciting? We're going to be taking bids for trash disposal this year. So that's the hauling and the dumping of trash from our recycling center. What we're seeing around the state, and I don't want to, you know, promise you this, but we're seeing a definite increase in those prices. We look pretty cheap right now. What we're really good at in my department is procurement. And, of course, we're going to be doing that as smartly as we possibly can. The biggie. I forgot to put on here, but we're also going to be looking at establishing another contract for composting and possibly anaerobic digestion if the city winds up getting a grant for that. The biggie. Every 10 years, we issue an RFP. I really thought I wasn't going to be here for this next one, but I will. We've gone through it now twice. And what is this? This is for everything that goes on at the recycling center. It's the garbage. It's the recycling processing. It's the delivery of the recyclables from residents to Ontario County's facility with all the bells and whistles. We process the commercial, primarily fiber here, which has paper, which has saved us tremendously in terms of what we're seeing around the state, where everything went into the same stream. We have a drop spot, as you know, for the public.
We do a lot of things. We manage about 20 materials, one of which is trash. The rest are all recyclable materials, as well as household hazardous waste. This process takes 18 to 24 months. There is a law that tells us how to go about it. And on the third round, the law still hasn't changed. And Jonathan and I, with my deputy, worked very, very closely together, along with some engineering services. This process is going to start next year. And by the end of the year, we should have a draft RFP. I like to have a stakeholders group that consists of the county administrator, myself, the attorney, a member of the committee that we serve, and it's been the finance director, to help guide through this process and ultimately get to the committee and to the legislature. But we're lucky now. Casella Recycling is not coming to us and asking for lots more money like is going on all over the state with other contractors. So we know it's going to change things a lot. All right, all that good news. But we're going to continue to divert materials, and that's the important thing. And we're going to be focusing on public space recycling, adding more residential opportunities. I'm excited because there's a grant that we just found out about that we hadn't figured on from the state for food scrap recycling. My initial reaction to that is we're going to focus on apartments. And we used to have a grant for mobile home parks for food scraps. Focus on apartments, especially with lower income. And we're going to look at that kind of service. I'm pretty excited about that opportunity. And it pays for staff that I normally don't have in other grants. So whoopee, we might get some money back if we get that grant. That would be nice. So here's the deal. Here's our expenses, $6.3 million, up only 2%. Look at this. Staff, I said about 20% infringe, 4% equipment, supplies, buildings, maintenance. But then look at this, 77% is contractual. I have probably close to 60 contracts, ranging from, say, the Science Center for Education to the big ones like the recycling and center operation and many in between. That's in your budget book as well. And the name of the game for me, some are nonprofits, like the Reuse Center, and there's leachate hauling, which is, you go every few years. We have to be really, really good at this so that we get exactly what we asked and no more, and we don't overpay. This is the area that is critical to keep ourselves stable. This is a graph that shows we have about 8 revenue sources, but the majority of revenue comes from these sources. So the annual fee, for those of you that are new to this, since we're an enterprise fund, we don't take any money from property taxes. The annual fee pays for all costs related to programs that are not related to garbage and disposal, okay? So that tends to be monitoring and maintaining old landfills. You'll be hearing about, you'll be seeing a new replacement well for one of them in your agenda tomorrow. It includes household hazardous waste collection for residents. It includes recycling collection. It includes the recycling processing cost net any revenue. And it also includes programs for waste reduction and our administrative costs. Disposal fees, that's what it costs for trash. By the way, in all of these are the staff costs involved. And we do what's called program-based budgeting. We have 7 unique budgets that total the $6.3 million. There's a lot of moving parts in this enterprise fund. So look at this. This is our problem. This has been the trend for our recycling revenues. And we're anticipating that It will not get better next year. So that really shows you a whole lot on one graph. That's an interesting color. I thought that was going to be a different color for the annual fee. So in any event, the annual fee that residents pay, as well as businesses. By the way, just so you know, for the newcomers, everyone pays the annual fee, including the colleges and school districts that don't pay property taxes. And we will have a quick discussion about that at the next committee meeting when I come with the fee structure for approval and then the legislature. Everyone pays. Disposal, that's 29% of our revenue source. And then miscellaneous. Now, that recycling used to be a much higher number, and obviously that's what's hurting. So that. All right.
Disposal. I'm sorry.
Garbage. Disposal.
How do we make money off of
that? It's a pass-through.
Oh, okay.
We charge a fee, and
is that
we... Yeah. That's a fee at the gate.
Thanks.
Yep. Or through trash tags, pay as you throw. And there's a lot of questions about that, I'm sure. But let me just finish this off. We can always go back to these things. So look at that. We have been remarkably steady. We've been adding a lot of programs over the years for the annual fee, and Joe and I tried very, very hard to keep that balanced. However, we can't do that this year. We are going to balance the budget if the annual fee goes from 55 to 58, which, just so you understand, $1 on the annual fee is about $50,000 in expenses. Remember, I told you that our budget is $900,000 in the red compared to the past, but I'm only recommending, Jason and I did an incredible amount of work with all of this, that we increase by $3, and we feel pretty confident, unless things got worse with recycling, which I definitely don't believe it will, that we're going to be okay with just that kind of increase. That isn't saying what's going to happen in the future as our expenses go up. But we need to, one of the things I do is I do a five-year budget. Okay, so I have that. And next year's committee will focus on our projections to better understand the future. What we might be talking about in future years is some changes in programs and how we decide to do work. It's just a possibility, but we have to all be open to different scenarios. This is important because it shows you, of the $58 that we're proposing per household, what are people paying for here? Okay? So, starting with recycling collection, of that pie, it's really almost half, if you will. But if you add recycling and recycling collection, that's a majority of the, but it doesn't pay for only recycling, which some people are under the impression of. It also pays for the household hazardous waste program, the administration with old landfills. You just can't shut the gate when they closed 20-something years ago. There's still pollution. There's still monitoring. There's still cap. There's a clay cap over the whole thing that has to be maintained for its integrity. And we also sample. We actually... 4 years ago, we have our own staff sampling instead of consultants because it saves us an awful lot of money and we think we do a better job. So that's one of the things that we do. And we have programs where we either do work ourselves in terms of reducing waste by preventing waste from being generated by the community. The reuse center is funded here in part, and so is cooperative extensions, home composting. I mentioned the Science Center. There's a bunch of little projects that we have going on there.
So that represents the fee, and that is my story for this particular year. Yeah.
Thank you, Barbara. Other questions? Mike, then Shauna.
I just have two questions. I'm sorry. We know that there's a price point for the one fee where people are going to start illegally dumping, right? Isn't it wiser to kind of raise the annual fee as opposed to the dumping fee?
Well, there's two issues at play. First of all, just to make sure you remember, we do have an illegal dumping enforcer, and he does catch a lot of people. Those trends have been going down, not up, actually. I mean, we've been doing it long enough, and people know you're going to get caught one way or the other. And that, by the way, the cost of the illegal dumping enforcer is in the disposal budget.
Gotcha.
Okay. And the reason that the disposal fee has to go up is because as you increase expenses, generally speaking, and the tonnage is going down slightly, you're having to make up for that. I'm also planning ahead a little bit because I know that when we award a bid in the fall, it isn't going to stay where it was, you know, 10 years ago. So.
Second question is, you had mentioned the siting of processing plants in the U.S. This, you probably don't know this. Is there any plans for New York State or
no.
Close by?
No. Close by, yes. There are facilities that are being proposed in Canada. We actually, our material right now, other than single-use bags, is not going to China. It stopped at the beginning of the year because of our relationship with Casella Recycling. That's how I wanted it. And those mills typically are in the Midwest. It's not that bad. But the main thing is, you know, with the China shutdown, it just takes money and time to rev up. The other thing is plastic processing is also growing. Now, I'm going to the annual recycling conference. I'm on the board of directors for the organization this month, actually, and I'm going to learn a lot about markets. And I'll definitely be keeping the committee up to date on what we're seeing and what's going on. But I am pretty satisfied right now that we're getting the best bang for the buck in terms of what we're doing. But New York State isn't typically friendly enough to these private businesses in terms of what kind of support is going on. There are venture capitalists like the Closed Loop Fund and others that are actually, you know, there's money being poured into these sorts of things. And it's about time. I mean, I said, you know, 25 years ago, when Waste Management in North America, the biggest company, was really like cahootsing with China, I knew this wasn't going to end well. Maybe it worked great for them for a while, but in the end, our country was going to suffer. Well, North America was going to suffer, yeah. Thanks, Mike. Yep.
Shauna?
Hey, Barb.
Hi.
Can you tell me why last year's overtime budget was 29?
Okay. Yeah. That's a really good question, because when I saw it, I was shocked, because it's incorrect. What's not incorrect is what Kevin did. But we misunderstood what that line was for. We only take $3,000 for overtime for the whole year, and that is for our Wayscale operators. So next year, we know, when we put the budget together, we're going to shift that into regular salary.
Kevin?
We probably will fix this before vote to adopt it. It's what would be considered a manifest error. It's just the way things appear in the budgeting system, and they have a lot of accounts, and it just wound up in the wrong bucket.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you could hear me squeal from my office desk when I saw that.
Thank you.
Yep.
Ann Corman.
Thanks, Barb, for the presentation and for anticipating a lot of this and helping keep the costs low. I had a question regarding, so the fee going up for the per ton of disposal, do you anticipate that and you said a new contract this year probably, so do you anticipate garbage tags or the as residential fees going up, or people are bringing in like bags of garbage?
Well, you know, we had a haulers meeting about this, and the haulers actually, the city of Ithaca is talking about increasing their fees for a variety of reasons. Their fee is very low because it includes collection, and their collection costs are going up, and that's different from all the other haulers that only include disposal in their fees. I do anticipate that in 2020 there will be an increase in terms of that fee. It's got to happen because that's how the haulers will balance what they do. But again, what, $5 over, you know, $85 is very not, very small amount of money in my mind. Yeah.
Deborah Dawson.
Hi, Barb. Quick question.
Deborah, there you
are. I'm over here. You said that everybody pays that household fee.
The annual fee.
The annual fee.
And the households are one of the payers.
Right. Is there a different, it's like a sliding scale for how much that fee is? Or does everybody just pay?
Well, if you're a homeowner, you pay. It's a separate line on your tax bill. If you're a renter, it tends to come out of the rent that you pay per year. That's pretty typical, and it's about $1 a week, you know, a little over $1 a week. So that's how it's paid for residents.
So if you build an apartment complex, for example, do you charge them $58 per unit?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct. There are different rates for seasonal homes and a slew of other categories. Let me take that opportunity when we're bringing that resolution forward, and I can answer any of the questions, because of course there's, you know, you'll be interested also in the college fees and you know, what businesses pay and everything that goes along with that.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Martha Robertson.
I'm okay.
Anna Kellis.
So the $3 increase. Hi, Barb.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Good. The $3 increase will lead to what total dollar increase?
So that's you mean what percentage? Or it's $3, and we're currently charging $55. So we're going to $58, and that's what, about a 5% increase?
Okay. Of your total budget.
Yeah. Of the piece of the budget that pays for. That pays for the $3.3 million part of the $6 million budget.
The 3.3 being the...
That's what the annual fee pays for. That's the non-disposal, that's the non-garbage piece of our budget for those programs.
So the annual fee is reserved only for that component.
Correct. That's the legal framework that we got state enabling legislation for.
Okay. So I'm just trying to piece all of these together. When I look at your expenses, 77% is the contractual.
Right.
That's of your total
million-something
budget. So part of that, I'm assuming, then must be the non.
Yeah. I don't have the exact number in my head, but it comes out of both the annual fee payments and the disposal fees. So, for example, the piece of the recycling center capital debt service per year, that would come out of recycling versus the disposal piece, and so on and so forth.
Thank you.
Yep.
Barbara, thank you. We appreciate
you
coming tonight.
Thank you.
Explaining your budget to us, as you always do. Next up is our airport. Mike Hall is our airport manager. This is budget book section 4, page 1. There are no over targets. Evening, Mike.
Good evening. Well, we're going to move through this fairly quickly, subject to your questions. The airport budget adjusted for inflation has been decreasing each of the last 4 years. Just a reminder that 2019 is an exciting year. We'll be having a groundbreaking. If I'd spoken to you at midday, I would have said it would have been Wednesday, but now it looks like it's going to be Friday. And I am meeting with the governor's assistant chief of staff tomorrow morning at 9:30 to try to sort out the who, what, where, when, and how. But stay tuned for an announcement about Friday. That's how we advertise the airport, and we need each of your help to make sure that our community backs this up, that every citizen, resident, guest, and visitor is treated with fairness, dignity, and respect. We are the most diverse community in New York, along with Queens, and we have a tremendous opportunity as a result of that. Last week, I had the opportunity to bring Zenity Holdings, a $30 billion Chinese firm, to Cornell University. First time that the airport has referred an economic development, potential economic development partner. New York State sent them to Liverpool. They chose instead to come here because they wanted a vibrant economy, a world-class university, and a welcoming community. So that's how important all this is to our future. And we have a second meeting coming up with them in New York City, so who knows where it'll go, but it's all built around the fact that you're welcome here. That's what we do for upstate New York. And that's the spark plug that runs the engine for sure. And our air service connects us with one stop to 750 global destinations. We have a ribbon cutting this Thursday. I hope you can join us. It's at gather about 1:15 in the airport terminal. Meet the first flight from Washington at 1:45 with a ribbon cutting. United Airlines is very serious about this. They have a spare airplane set aside in case there's a problem with the original ones. That's how much they want to arrive on time. Their president of New York and New Jersey operations will be here along with Matt Colbert, who's a local guy. He's Tom Colbert's son. He graduated from Ithaca High and Cornell. And we're meeting with President Pollack right after the ribbon cutting. It's very, very important to us because United Airlines' global network overlies Cornell's requirements better than anybody else's. So the more we can turn United into a carrier that is growing in market share in Ithaca rather than shrinking, which they have been over the past few years because of the poor reliability of Newark service, this gives us an opportunity to grow them, grow the airport, and support Cornell all at once. And then, of course, next up is Charlotte in December. Just a day a week to start out, but with a promise that that service will grow if it's used. And I suspect you'll see the same kind of thing relative to Philadelphia, that eventually American Airlines will unload Philadelphia in favor of Charlotte, which is an advantage to us because Charlotte will be very reliable, as will be Washington, and we know that Philly and Newark are not. Big projects, terminal expansion, groundbreaking now Friday. Three phases, each equal in about $8 million a phase, give or take. The first phase is under contract to Streeter Associates from Elmira. It was to be federally funded. We did not receive funding in round one of the Supplemental Airport Improvement Program funds that were just announced. We will be playing in round two. We're told by everyone concerned that our prospects are solid in round two, but, you know, we have to wait and see. We're going to have to wait till the 1st of January, so I'm not going to get much sleep between now and then. Meantime, we received approval from New York State to swap the state funds in place of the federal in round one, and the federal funds will now do round two. You'll obviously be updated you know, as quickly as we know anything about how that whole situation develops, because it's of great significance to us. One of the reasons that Zenity Holdings came here is because that by the end of next year, they'll be able to fly nonstop from Beijing to Ithaca if they want to check on their investments. So this issue of becoming an international airport is extremely important to business in the community. The New York State DOT residency, we will be back to you for a closing, but essentially we're now working with the FAA to get a deed release, and stay tuned for the timing of further developments. And finally, we have an open request in to move our fuel farm out of a congested area on the airport to a location down behind the sheriff's office, at which point we'll be able to pump fuel both sides of the fence and take care of the government fleet vehicles that that need contract fuel in addition to airplanes and airport equipment. Just a reminder on the terminal, these are the things that we have to accomplish. They take place in each of the three phases. The first phase, which is set to groundbreak, is where you enter the terminal. It'll be the ticketing area and the baggage makeup area. The next phase will be the departure and arrival concourse, and the last phase will be the customs facility. And that's what it'll look like when it's all done, hopefully with that many airplanes. And this is really where we're going. I'm not going to get into, because we've got almost caught up on time here, but I'm not going to get into the details of this, but we'll be back to you as this plan develops going forward. It's one of the things where the county and the governor's long-term objectives overlie very closely, and it's an opportunity for us to work together with the state to accomplish something very special. This is the way it phases out. Groundbreaking the 5th instead of the 4th. The rest of the phases bid out and constructed, and by the end of 2019, it'll all be done. Okay, now to the detail of our budget. This is where we stand for 2019. As I said, in real dollars, this budget has declined each of the last 4 years, and that's thanks to the woman sitting to my left here, who does an incredible job of running the business of the airport. You can't lose a penny up there with Roxanne watching. So that's our impact, and no changes in the FTEs. Those FTEs that you're seeing, that's primarily administration and then ops and firefighters, that group. Tommy flew safely, so I slept through Saturday night for the first time in a while. Subject to your questions.
Mike, can I just mention something first? If this event is being pushed over till Friday, we have our transportation meeting Friday. We might have to adjust that, but your resolutions for your bonding are on that agenda. So let's keep in touch and try to figure out what we need to do.
I will. Friday's an unusual day, and I think I'll get in touch with you right after I meet with Kelly tomorrow and see what the second floor is planning. And the other thing is, we had originally discussed doing this in the terminal, but now I think they're leaning toward doing it in the hangar again because they know exactly how to set that up, and you know, it worked very well last May. So I will certainly let Jason and the legislature know as soon as that meeting's over tomorrow if there's a firm decision.
Thank you. Other questions? Deborah?
We can always have our transportation meeting at the airport.
Well,
I would also offer, if the committee wants to meet at the airport, if the timing's tight or something, that's certainly an option.
That's a good option. Deborah, are you done?
Yeah.
Ann Corman.
Thanks, Mike and Roxanne, for all the great work you guys do there. And that was fun watching Tommy take off and land.
especially the latter.
Yes. It didn't look like the pilot wanted to come down. It looked like they were having fun. Let's see. A couple questions. And probably you've said this before. When are we going to find out about the next round of funding?
The next round of funding has to be submitted on October 31st. We set a meeting today with the FAA in New York City on October 16th to go over our application, get their comments, and revise it, you know, to make it as strong as we possibly can. It'll be submitted October 31st, and the projected announcement is January 1st. Well, you know, it's not going to be January 1st, but hopefully it'll be very close to that. The money is already obligated, so it won't get caught in some of the federal budget machinations that might take place. So we're pretty firm about that. And the timing of the Phase 2 bidding is such that that money would be applicable if we receive it. And I'll tell you offline, we've done a lot to make sure we receive it, and we're going to continue to do a lot, especially with our federal representatives.
Can I ask two more questions? Okay. Charging stations. Are there going to be charging stations in the new parking lots?
Yes, there will be.
Electric vehicles?
Yep.
Okay, great. And just one last question. Oh, for the fuel farm. So it sounds like that's going as planned as far as the DOT is also going to be able to use.
Right. The goal is to get DOT to fund the fuel farm moving, and then we'll pump fuel for DOT as well as for the airport.
Okay, great. So they can hopefully fund that.
let's go to Martha Robertson next.
Yeah, congratulations again on Saturday. And you just, you know, you're just all event planners. That's really what your job is these days. So you must be about your Phase 2 solicitation. It's supposed to go out, what, tomorrow or so? I'm looking at your timeline here.
Yeah, the timeline is a gross timeline there. It's all being carefully timed and orchestrated with the FAA to make sure that we receive notification about federal award before we need to.
Okay, so that was... Right, you said the 15th or something like that. Where are we on the geothermal system for the terminal and NYSERDA and NYSEG and anything else coming in for that?
Katie's doing a wonderful job supporting us and working that. We met with Jason today. NYSEG and NYSERDA are actively soliciting detailed information from CNS so that they can turn around and tell us which of the existing programs they have that will apply and how much we can get. That's sort of separate from the possibility still of a no pipe alternative play. So this is the regular stuff, and then if no pipe alternative develops in a certain way, we'd be considered there also. The challenge we have, and I'll tell you, CNS worked all weekend because the governor's staff went back and forth over renderings of the airport, which you will see on Friday. So the bandwidth that they have is tough, but I think we're going to be able to get together with NYSEG this week for a walkthrough, and they'll start feeding them information. So it's all coming along, but everybody wants everything right away, and that's fair enough.
Thank you.
Anyone else? All right. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Roxanne. Now we go to the Office of Human Rights. It's Section 4, page 138. There is an over-target, number 70, which, if I'm not mistaken, is an over-target requested by administration.
Yes, that's correct.
Dr. Kenneth Clark is here for us.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I wanted to acknowledge the help and assistance of Kevin and Jonathan and Jason in the development of the budget for 2019. This is an overview of the recommended budget for this coming year. You'll notice that there is a revenue under revenue under 2018 minus $8,800. And you also see a change of $53,000 for the 2019 recommended budget. And I'll explain both of those in a moment. Excuse me. Here you see the over-target request that is supported by the recommended budget, which has to do with OHR's proposed relocation. And I'll elaborate on that shortly as well. The rollover revenue, that minus $8,800, is related to unspent 2018 funds for conferences and also for fair housing testing, which was planned for 2018 but did not materialize. Fair housing testing has to do with sending persons out, individuals out with the intent or alleged intent to purchase a home on an apartment or rent an apartment, but they do so in order to gather information and to determine whether or not fair housing practices are being exercised by renters or realtors. But that that funding was not utilized. The change of $53,360 is reflective of the funding that's been proposed to relocate OHR to the COFA building, or to the Human Services Index, in 2019. There's several reasons for this relocation. One is that our current location at 120 Martin Luther King Jr. Street is not the most accessible of locations. The current location that we're in right now is one that is rented by the county, and so we are paying rent for that. And by relocating to a county building, that will help to decrease the facilities budget. The current location has a number of issues, and in some ways is slowly deteriorating. We will move into the new location with a lease for 5 years with a one-year notice. This relocation is the result of an administrative review of county-owned space and space rented by the county. And hence, as you see, that this was not requested by OHR, but was recommended by the county administrator, and I accepted that recommendation. This relocation would also put OHR on the county's IT system, which would provide some significant bandwidth improvement. There are some days it's sort of like using a 1990s modem in our building. Things go a little quite slow. But this would put us on the county system, which will really improve our internet access. And so the actual targeted budget, in light of that, the $50,000 that will be used to basically to renovate that space and make it work for us as an office. As a result, that means that the targeted budget is $331,422, including 3% salary increases and fringes. Here you see our full-time equivalents over the last 3 years and what is targeted and what is proposed for 2019. This chart reflects a reduction in OHR's FTEs for 2019. The paralegal aid position will be discontinued. The New York State Department of Human Rights no longer requires OHR to engage in an in-depth process to draft claims, perform legal research, or write rebuttals. And that change has created a void of labor in this position. And given the uncertainty about the future, for instance, the search which will lead to a new OHR director, the reestablishment of the Human Rights Commission, we want to keep the current budget in place and reallocate the funds from this position to bolster education and outreach initiatives. What follows is now several activities for this upcoming year. As noted here, the proposed contacts with State Division and county offices really builds upon contacts that we initiated this past summer while doing the OHR assessment. And so what we are seeking to do is to build on those connections that we have established and strengthen those connections and those networks. excuse me. And also, given that we, the way in which we are basically helping individuals file complaints with the state and file those directly with the state, we assist them with that. We will be following up with those complainants at 30-day intervals after their initial filing, just to sort of keep abreast of what's going on with them, check in with them, and then ultimately by 90 days, check to determine just what their status is in terms of their, whether or not there's been any contact with the state. And if not, then to see what we can do to support them in their efforts to address their concerns. we will be in touch with and consulting with county OHR offices that offer conciliation and mediation services with the intent of providing or finding out, getting insight on the ways in which these offices address these matters. I'm looking forward to working with a new Human Rights Commission to explore the range of options that we can pursue in this regard. I will also be seeking the Commission's insight and input in working specifically with Kim Cornish from our office as well as Jonathan Wood on the details of expanding education and outreach and advocacy regarding issues of human rights and such for the community. In early 2019, we expect that they will begin a search for a new director. And the conclusion of this search might provide some additional direction and shape to the proposed budget. And so that is, in a nutshell, our presentation. I welcome your questions, comments.
Thank you. Let's start with Rich, and then I have Anna and someone over here. Shauna.
Let me start out by saying thank you for stepping up. This is really good to see you here. I did have a question on your budget. Where is rent shown? Which line is that in?
It's actually not in the OHR budget. It's in the facilities budget.
Ah, okay.
So any lease payments that we have for any facility is out of facilities.
Right. What is the current rent?
It's just under $30,000 a year.
Thank you.
Yep.
Anna?
There's a reduction in one FTE, but there's an increase in the salaries of the remaining people by the 2% cost of living adjustment. Is that? Okay. The other question I had, or several questions that I had, when you talk about the support of the state, what I understand that to be, and this is just running it by you so I understand the staffing of this. This is the slide five, continued dialogue with the state about how to best assist complainants.
Right.
So what has been discussed in the public and what seems to be a discrepancy is the belief that it is going to be a kiosk that people will use and that will be the extent of the support. My understanding from talking to you, and I'm trying to now understand where that would be as far as the staffing is concerned, is that it will be an extensive process where if someone comes in, we can support them with the filing. We can create even a calendar of when are they supposed to hear back from the state for an interview, when would be their hearing date, when should the state connect with them, when do they need to submit their appeal request if they need to change the hearing date, that entire process, which is quite extensive support above and beyond what I understand has been happening per se, or is the system in place because we've been doing investigation. Who is going to be doing that process? Because that's an extensive amount of work, reaching out to the state, keeping in touch with the complainants, keeping in touch with the state, being the advocates for the complainants in that way.
Well, I will be the one that will be in touch, will be doing it because I'm the person that assists the complainants in filing their forms with the state. In terms of, I mean, I would be a little careful, in terms of the advocacy part. I think while we are assisting individuals, we really are not in a position where we should serve as advocate.
It's a wrong word, I think. I think
per se. I mean, we certainly want to support them in their efforts, but we cannot, as Jonathan has said a number of times, we cannot represent a party.
Right. I don't mean advocate as far as defense against someone else. I mean with respect to the relationship to the state.
Right.
Helping keep them in touch with the state, keep the state engaged. Right. So that would be the director's role. Right. The other component is that the budget is staying the same, and the intention is to, once a director is hired, that director can reevaluate the method of education, outreach, and enforcement that is done and come up with a plan and reach back out to.
Well, some of this will be done prior to the hiring of a new director, I mean, in terms of, at least in terms of my role as interim, I mean, in terms of the reallocation of those resources toward education and outreach to bolster that. And we'll talk a little bit more in detail about at least an outline of that when the fuller report is available.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Shauna Black.
Hello, Ken.
Hi.
I was wondering, the decrease in salary is definitely something new to me because my understanding was that we would actually keep the salaries the same and then allow the new director to make any new hires that might be needed. I'm also a bit concerned because I think whenever we look for a new director, we could be looking to someone that is an attorney, and we could also be paying more for that. So I don't know if this is a question to you, Jason, if we could increase that salary amount, because it looks like what you might have done is actually move that salary line down to the program expense.
That's all that was done. Yeah, the salary was preserved in the budget itself. If it doesn't commit it to anything other than at this point in time, if there's a different hiring or a different framework of the department in the future years, you can reallocate those funds to salary lines.
Mm-hmm.
And it's where you would preserve the funding right now for the time being. If there's an intent to change the funding, to change the staffing structure, we can do that at that point in time. It would just be a budget adjustment.
Okay. And is there any reason why the supplies went down $2,800 and the traveling and training went down $2,400?
Well, that is related to the role of, I mean, the fact that there was certain planned conference travel that did not occur.
Okay. That is something that I would also like to see remain the same due to the fact that we will have a new director and we definitely want to invest in our employees.
That was, I think, when you're looking at prior year, it was increased to a one-time rollover. So I think it's at the same levels it was in prior year, Shauna.
Right.
It's just when you're looking at it to the prior year, it's looking at it at a higher amount because the rollover
Gotcha.
Was a one-time expense.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Ann Corman.
Thank you. I had a question. I know you're looking at, you know, still a lot of overall for the whole department. You're looking at the structure of it. And so I'm just wondering, though, for the description that we have here in our budget book on page 138 in section 4, it still says OHR is charged with filing complaints and conducting investigations of discrimination.
Yeah, I think that's language that I think that, you know, just needs to be updated, that we have not had a chance to address, and part of that I think is related to, I think, as was mentioned in the email exchange, that after the assessment has been done, that will be probably a more opportune time to make those edits in the language in the budget document.
Martha Robertson.
Hi, Ken. Thanks. I agree with what Rich has said about we really appreciate this is tough for an interim director. We really appreciate you doing all this. The language on page 142 seems to be more current with what you're you've been doing and what we're enabled to do.
I think Kevin responded. It's just a correction of language that needs to be updated once the budget's adopted and some different directions given. Yeah.
Right. So just that's a good page. That's a good description that it exists right here, so people can find that. I did look at the rollover. You've got. it looks like more than $27,000 in rollover. So, especially for a small department, that's certainly plenty for travel and training as next year rolls out. The Office for the Aging Space, I just want to make sure people understand it's not going to become part of the Office for the Aging, right? It's
correct.
A wholly separate space with its own doors and locks and access to bathrooms and separate space. I mean, it's a great meeting space, and it's bigger than where the office is now, right?
Yes. So if you're familiar with the COFA building, if you go to the back end of the building, there's actually a common hallway that would split the Office for Aging space and the new OHR space. So that can all be controlled through electronic locks like it is now. It'll be a separate entranceway. We'll make it ADA accessible so you have clear accessibility. The space, square footage-wise, is a little bit bigger, and we'll be able to create some office space in there, some conference room meeting space in there. So it's a new furnished space. I mean, it'll be newly furnished. It'll be a better outfit. We'll make sure one of the questions that's come up in a recent group that I know Ken and I met with about signage, we'll make sure we have proper signage up, at least on the Albany Street and probably also on the Martin Luther King Jr. side street of it. You know, that's kind of one of those things you'll get a feel for once the place opens up, as where need better signage needs to be put out there. But signage is one of those things that we'll also improve. So it's a better space. It'll be ADA accessible.
Yeah, the entrance way will be on the Albany Street side.
Yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. That's right.
Right. And there's parking. I mean, the DSS, the Human Services building lot is nearby, and although that's often full, but that's also available if clients come or, people, the public comes. That's a nearby parking space. So there's no, I've heard comments about it being wrapped into the Office for the Aging.
No.
Nothing
two
like
separate,
that.
Two
at
separate
all.
Departments.
Right. Okay. And then the other thing about being on the county's IT system, I guess that's obviously better security as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The IT phone system.
Right.
You know, right now they're on a different, totally separate system, so it's just probably a convenience issue.
Okay. And then you have down here that about visiting the Binghamton State Department office.
Mm-hmm.
Do all of our complaints go to the Binghamton office? They don't. That's what I understand. Not Syracuse. Not New York. Is that right?
I would say most, as far as I know, many do. It all depends on the nature of the discrimination claim as well, that some other state offices might handle other types of claims. But usually Binghamton.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Henry Granison.
Yes, you have, when you think about will follow up with complainants after 30 days, What's the process going on now?
Well, right now, and I don't want to get too much into the weeds of this, but right now we take in the complaint. A person files their complaint, and they submit it. They get it notarized. They send it as a PDF to the state, and then. And so now, I mean, I'm really kind of coming toward my first 30-day cycle with this. And so I will be following up with the first two or three complainants that I helped, to check in with them and to touch base with them and also to remind them that, this process takes time, before they may hear from the state. And so it's that's what the process is right now, going forward. But the key thing is to maintain some constant communication with them, during a process they have to wait through when they have, filed a complaint about something that they, that has very much, affected them often in very negative ways.
And if you could just talk a little bit about what you've, what the state office had told you about best handling complaints.
Well, to have complaints directly come to the state, that we are to, they are to be filled out by the complainant. We assist complainants with them, but we need to ensure that the complainants are being able to tell their story in their own words. My role is to make sure that they are able to say as clearly as possible what took place and that they are able to communicate that as effectively as possible. That's what their expectation is of us, and that we, you know, will not, you know, adhere to what had been past practice in terms of, you know, a more lengthy, in-depth type of process. This is what the state is requesting of us.
Deborah Dawson next.
Thank you. Thank you for being here, Dr. Clark.
Mm-hmm.
Before I get to my questions for you, though, I'm curious, Martha, you referenced a $27,000 rollover.
Mm-hmm.
Where is that?
In your first section, the budget overview, or second? Wait, I'll find it. It is page, section 2, page 24, all the departments, the use of rollover where there's a department. So it shows what's carried from prior years, what's used now, and then what's recommended for 2019, and what the balance is.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
So, Dr. Clark, I had a couple of questions about the activities
mm-hmm.
that you mentioned for next year. You mentioned contacting county OHRs that provide conciliation mediation services. Has our OHR ever provided conciliation and mediation services?
In the past, according to the history, going all the way back to the time an investigator was hired, the predecessor to the director position back in 1975, conciliation and resolution, as it was called, was utilized in a number of instances when people came with concerns because it was in the according to by the discernment of the investigator, they did not feel that their concerns would rise to the level of filing a formal complaint. And so they provided conciliation and resolution, as they called it, during that time. It was something that was done by the investigator, and I know in particular the late Teddy Zimrot utilized that oftentimes did that kind of conciliation and resolution type of work according to annual reports of OHR. So there was a time in which we actually did this directly. I'm not aware that conciliation, for instance, was, say, farmed out, let's say, for example, to the Conflict Resolution Dispute Center or some other entity. But as I understand it, it was largely done within the office by the investigator and subsequently the director.
So if we had that capability now, if there was someone in the office that could do that, how many cases do you think, I mean, what percentage of the caseload that you see would be willing to do that and would avail themselves of that opportunity, and how might that lead to faster resolutions?
It's hard to say what that might look like percentage-wise. Even from year to year, I mean, that could vary considerably. I'm kind of hard-pressed to give you an answer to that. I'm really not sure.
I can add a little bit to it. Some of the information that we've looked at with different data, obviously, you know, two parties can willingly go through a conciliation or mediation process absent of a claim if they so choose or not. The claim itself, if a claim is filed, there is a conciliation process that may take place at the state level as well. Mm-hmm. So it can depend on the individuals, the parties at hand, whether or not they're willing to discuss issues or resolve issues or not, depending if there's a claim involved. One other thing I would say, that some of the research, preliminary research that we did identify, is the majority of the human rights offices are one to two people, and there are a few of them that do contract or work with similar type outsourcing services, dispute mm-hmm. resolution agencies, to help either mitigate or help come to resolutions. And what Dr. Clark and I have talked about is understanding what type of relationship do they have, how do they relay individuals on, and that type of thing. So there are examples of other agencies, other OHR, you know, Office of Human Rights and other counties that do work in partnership with outside agencies for that type of service.
Well, that was my concern, because it seemed to me that if I were the respondent to a complaint of discrimination, I would be reluctant to submit myself to mediation or conciliation done by OHR staff, since OHR staff is really working for the benefit of the complainant or petitioner, and as they should be.
It comes to, I mean, I think what it comes down to is two things. One, during an investigatory process, you know, there has to be a third party reviewing that.
So exactly.
Technically, the office, if there were to, in the prior roles, when it had a member of understanding, it would have filled that third party role. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a link between trying to resolve matters versus moving them forward. I think part of what Dr. Clark and I have talked about is, let's understand the relationship that other offices have had with third parties. How do they you know, make it a seamless transition or seamless, you know, a handoff or interaction? And providing those opportunities for folks. But at the end of the day, absent of a claim, sure, it's both parties have to want to be willing to meet on those issues.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things we want to do is to really explore with the commission, for example, you know, what options should we look at, and which ones would work best for our context?
Anna and Shauna would both like another set of questions, and then I hope we can come to a conclusion. Shauna's passing. Anna?
One addition to the conversation about the location, which was really glad, Martha, you brought that up, is that last year the office made it really clear to us that there were concerns about their existing facility because it was not ADA compliant.
Yes.
And is not ADA compliant. So part of the reason for the move is that we need a building that's ADA compliant.
That's always preferable. I mean, right. We're a government building, and so most government offices, we want to make sure we can provide that as much as we can.
So I just wanted to make that distinction, because that hadn't been brought up. The other point about the salary that you made, mm-hmm. if we had left the salary in the salary line, we wouldn't have been justified in keeping it in that budget, because there wouldn't be an FTE, but right. You put it in the program line in order to preserve it in the department funding.
Yes.
And then it can be reevaluated by the new director.
Absolutely.
So it's an intention to preserve the money in the department.
Yes.
Okay. And the last question I had was conciliation. In the past, was it done by you said it was done by the director, and prior to that?
Yeah.
Was the director at that time a lawyer?
No. In fact, as far as I can ascertain, the last three directors were lawyers, but prior to that, non-lawyers were either investigators or directors. Teddy Zimbrot, I understand, was a social worker, and she was the longest-serving director of OHR, 12 years. So Scott Heyman, at one point, was an investigator for OHR before they moved sometime in the 80s. The investigator became the director.
Okay, so conciliation is a powerful tool that we need, that we can negotiate, and that does not need to be done by a lawyer.
By a lawyer, no. I mean, I think it requires, I mean, if say, for instance, we were to take this on ourselves, it would require a certain level of training to be able to do that effectively and competently. But that's one among a number of options we need to consider.
Okay. Ken, we thank you so much tonight for coming.
You're welcome.
Your very clear presentation to us, and we'll move on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going now to the Office of Emergency Response. Do you want a break?
Yeah.
Okay, let's take 7 minutes. At the podium is Lee Shurtleff, our Director of Emergency Response. This is Budget Book Section 4, page 81. There's one over target, number 40, which has been recommended. Lee, when you're ready.
Thank you, Mike. Just to start, a year ago when I met with the Expanded Budget Committee, we began a discussion about the future needs of the department, in particular with the topics of succession planning and future transition. And the submission that here tonight primarily focuses on that. Just briefly, the recommended budget includes some changes both in expenditures and revenues, and I'll elaborate on that. And those expenditures are driven both by contractual increases that have been negotiated as well as the over-target request. Revenues relates back to the 911 surcharge. Major influences, we've been working over the past few years to diversify the revenue sources within the budget and been fairly successful in identifying grant funding and reimbursements through various funds in the state. We've also expanded the number of co-locators at our communications sites, which has helped to offset some of the loss of revenues. Of particular concern moving forward is the continued diminishment of the landline surcharge. And early next year, we will be bringing you a resolution to ask the state legislature to continue the dollar surcharge that is on landlines now and sunsets next year. As I said, that revenue line has continued to decrease, and so as a matter of caution, we have reduced those anticipated revenues for 2018 to bring them in line with what we've historically been receiving over the past several years. Expenses, as mentioned, will reflect the contractual increases in administrative reorganization. Full-time equivalencies remain at 30.5. The budget request reflects the full funding of those 30.5. And we've set right in this range of 30 FTEs in the department for at least the past half dozen years. Over-target request goes toward the Department of Emergency Response reorganization. And I will expand upon that a little bit by showing an organization chart. Probably doesn't show very well for you, but what we are seeking to do is move an assistant director's position and make it a full-time deputy director position with oversight over the planning administrative functions of the office. We have lacked that since I've been director. There's no one particular number two that's there. It's less concerning from an administrative standpoint than it is to me in the implementation of emergency plans. You need a clear-cut number two deputy director that can move in and implement your emergency plans in the absence of a director and provide that succession capability. We started last year with the concept of funding a fire disaster and EMS coordinator. That's included in this, and we're also looking to take the assistant EMS director's position, reclassify it to more accurately portray what those duties are as a community preparedness coordinator. And the total request is the $66,000, which includes the payroll and fringe benefits costs. I guess I would open it for questions at this point.
I can, Mike.
Go ahead, Jay.
Just there's just one correction we have. Is the community, what will be the community preparedness coordinator? It's currently a part-time position. that OTR proposes it to being a full-time position. So it actually, and I just caught this earlier, I spoke with Kevin, it's actually a half an FTE increase as part of the OTR. So it would go from 30 and a half to 31 full-time employees. It's just something, we missed, I think, just putting the budget numbers together.
Lee, I have a question. In general, I know we have a disaster plan that gets updated now and then. Where are we in that process? Is it due for update? Has it been updated recently? Where are we?
The main portion of the comprehensive plan is being updated, as well as the fire disaster and mutual aid plan that is under revision. We have a county hazard mitigation plan, all jurisdictions, which will come up, I believe, next year for its five-year review. And that's coordinated through the county planning department, and they avail themselves of hazard mitigation dollars to usher us through that process. And with that, we take parts of that and factor it into the comprehensive plan every 5 years.
Thank you. Martha Robertson.
Hi, Lee. A couple questions. So you're, Jason, did you just say that the FTE chart should say 31 for 2019?
I believe so, yes. Recommended 31.
Okay.
It's a half an FTE increase. Is that right? That sounds right, Lee?
It does. The current incumbent works 30 hours a week, and I believe we have it placed in the budget as a 0.5 FTE, and it's been underfunded in dollars for several years. So this puts it to that FTE number and then funds it accordingly.
Yes.
So I would ask that we, if we could possibly get that chart so that I could read it. Just on one page, because it's really small. And
we can get you an updated org chart.
Well, and if there's, like, including identify who's less than full-time. Like, we can just assume everybody on there is full-time,
right.
But...
So there's two interests. What's being proposed to being changed to the fire disaster and EMS coordinator?
Mm-hmm.
The position is currently fully funded, but is only being worked part-time by the incumbent. That would be changed. That would be the title would be changed. The position would be filled on a full-time basis. And then the only other part-time is what will be the community preparedness coordinator that is, you know, filled as a part-time, and it would be upgraded to a full-time as well. Both changing titles and both going from part-time to upgrade to full-time status.
All right, but the deputy director, is that new altogether?
No, it is an existing position that will have a new title and an upgrade into a deputy director role.
Okay, and so what you're saying is all of those changes add up to $66,200?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and what about... we've talked about succession planning in a number of departments. Does this include time for Lee to be hanging around while we have some overlap?
Well,
Lee
and I talked about his transition. I think what we would do, assuming if when the budget is adopted, we would go out and advertise for the position. I think the expectation is that we'd have some overlap with an incoming director. Probably Lee's last working day would be, you know, somewhere in the springtime.
Okay.
April 1st, maybe sooner.
Great date.
It's a great.
Okay.
But we accounted for some overlap, you know, with the incoming director.
Got it. Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Shauna.
Hi, Lee. Can you tell me why the rent is increased by $19,000?
Yes. We've got two parts to that. One is that we've added a co-locator at Ithaca College, and we've also had some contractual increases, slight percentage increases from some of the others, 2 or 3% here and there. And some of it comes mid-year and some comes at the beginning of the calendar year. Now, with most of the sites, when we have a co-locator on it, we split that revenue with a landlord based on an existing contract. So that's where these numbers don't exactly get you to a 50-50 split. There's some mid-year reflections here.
Okay. Thank you.
Ann.
Thank you, Lee. I was wondering about the position for the deputy director. Is that, are you going to get rid of somebody that's there, or somebody's going to transition into that position, an actual person?
It would be a reclassification of an existing assistant director to deputy director with some additional responsibilities, same individual.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Lee.
Can I add one just personal note here for a second, Mike, while I've got the microphone? I just wanted to state, make mention that this was my 22nd budget presentation as either a director or deputy director of this department, just this department. And when we started down this road, we had a number of objectives that were involved in that. And through the 22 budgets, we've pretty much doubled the size of the budget, doubled the number of personnel, but at the same time have been able to identify and secure a number of, outside revenues that have helped us take care of that growth. We've consolidated dispatch. We've built a 911 center. We carried out a $20-plus million capital project, and probably the airport will finally surpass us in being the largest capital project in the county. And we developed a fully recognized comprehensive emergency planning division. And through all of that, I just want to extend my appreciation to this legislature and county administration and county finance for your support and collaboration and input into that. This budget process has really driven the ability for our department to meet those goals that we set many years ago. And I think that this budget probably provides the most stable fiscal financial footing that we've ever had. This looks really good for the future leadership of the department to be able to work with. And it also leaves us well positioned for initiatives for next generation 911, public safety, broadband, and fully interoperable operations and communications. And couldn't have been done without the support of this legislature and administration. And I just very simply want to say thank you for that support. You truly invested in the public safety of Tompkins County, and it's paid dividends for our citizens. I appreciate it.
That's very kind of you, Lee.
Thank you for your dedication.
22 budgets, unfortunately, you have to keep doing them until you get them right. Arthur Robertson.
Yeah, Lee, it is. I don't know if people know you started out in the Board of Elections. Am I right?
Yeah, that was another 8 budgets that I prepared.
Right, as a commissioner of the Board of Elections, and when I came in, and it was, it seems like we were using baling wire and cups and string, you know, and so it's come a very, very long way. So thank you for everything.
Thank you. I'm not going too far. I'll be home watching it on TV. Political junkie, I can't leave that stuff alone.
You're welcome to come in person.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Lee.
All right, now we're to the county administration and the capital portion of our budget. There are a number of OTRs. This is Section 4, page 126. Looks like there are 9 OTRs, and wonder of wonder, they're all recommended by county administration. So this might be the first place we could start cutting. Jason Molino, our county administrator.
Thank you very much. I should say that having this, I think this is the 6th expanded budget committee meeting that I've been to, and seeing the trend in the past 5 meetings, I wanted to make sure this one was only kept to 40 slides so we could get through it in a decent time tonight. So I'm going to cover a lot of information. I'm going to talk about the county administration budget. I'm going to talk about Stop DWI. I'm going to talk about the Tompkins Center of History and Culture. I'm going to talk about the contingent fund. I'm going to talk about the capital plan. And then we'll start with the second half of the presentation. So we've got a little bit to cover. I would like to say just two things. One, our DA talked about this being the first day of Raise the Age. Pat Buchel was so prepared for this that she decided to take the next 3 weeks off on vacation, so she missed the first day. Also, this is the first day of Amy Hendricks' first day in county admin as our deputy. I definitely want to make sure she has the longest of the six meetings that she attends. As we'll go through, just a brief, this is county admin budget. As you can see, some increases there over the prior year, nothing significant within target. That $12,000 change is, for the most part, $10,000 worth of rollover from the prior from into this next year, and I'll talk about that in one of the OTRs. As you know, the majority of that budget is personnel-related. Here are some non-personnel items. Some not, you know, are parked here, I think, just due to not necessarily having a home. So, for example, you can see there's two different amounts of expenses there. The CCE contract for Ledge Broadcasting staff, that's for our folks up in the glass room up there that stay just as late as we do. Being able to staff the cameras and the systems so that people can watch it live and have the history of it online. The downtown community outreach worker, or the COW, so to speak, is parked here in this budget. WDIC support is parked in this budget. Also last year, or this year, I should say, was the first year of continuing service fees and maintenance contract for the broadcasting system. So as you can see, some of the one-time or the rollovers also here, but these are the non-personnel-related items under the county administration budget. Full-time equivalents, so this is a little bit of an interesting movement here. As you can see, in 2018, 10 FTEs were approved in this current budget. That included two full-time fellows, and I'll talk about the fellows in a little bit. The fellows were not filled. It was part of the fellow program that was created. I'll talk a little bit about that. So the target for 2019 dropped by 2 to 8, and then it was increased by 1 in the recommended budget because of the criminal justice coordinator that is located. It was hired at the beginning of the year and is located in the county admin budget. So technically, it's a net change of 1 decreased staff member. OTRs, there are a few OTRs in this budget. I'll go down them quickly, and I'm happy to answer any questions. We did put some funding aside this year for $22,500 to hire a consultant to assist with the implementation of the climate survey. This has to do with hiring a consultant to assist and facilitating the several different teams that will come out of this process to work on different items with respect to the climate survey results. The second one there, priority number 2, is the criminal justice coordinator. This is year 2, or 2019 will be year 2 of year 3 of that position. Dave Sanders has filled that position. He is in our office upstairs. And I think you've had several presentations, or at least public safety has, with some of the things that he's working on and getting that program off the ground. Not only is he working on the ATI aspect of things, but he's also doing the performance measurement program for the county. Next would be the county performance measurement project, which is year 3 of 3. This has to do with a series of consultant fees and licensing fees with respect to the performance measurement project. This year will mark the third year of an incorporation of the last 10 or so departments into the performance measurement program. $10,000 rollover. This is my contribution to sharing a vehicle with Jay Franklin, an assessment. As Jay enlightened you earlier, we agreed to share a vehicle, but it's going to be a smart car, so we thought it'd be good to have, you know, it's 6'4" to 6'2" guy in a smart car. But he and I are going to be sharing a vehicle. That's primarily because there's a lot of times where I use a vehicle. Now with Amy and Lisa in the office, it's more likely we're going to be using vehicles a little bit more to get around from meeting to meeting that aren't within walking distance. So I offered to share that vehicle with him as he was replacing one. And we are going to have an EV. We are thinking about a smart car, but if that doesn't work out, we'll get another electric car. $10,000, another, this is a a renewal of the of what was in this year's budget, the support for the city of Ithaca Parks planning. As you may know, there's been a planning process about what to do about parks, and this was kind of the next phase of the evaluation process. It was supposed to take place this year. It has not. We think it will take place next year, so we're considering suggesting you consider it again for 2019. Last piece is $25,000 for engineering for capital and planning space. Going through two series of capital planning processes next year. One would be an update of the capital policy, the capital planning policy, and two, looking for the solution for downtown space needs in our segregated location of different offices. All of that we think will require some engineering assistance, whether it be for sketching, whether it be for estimating of costs, those types of things. Engineering costs kind of come into play here. We had a ballpark figure that this is what we might need through either one or two separate contracts with our engineers. Personnel-related OTRs, again, here is the criminal justice coordinator, year two of year three. And public admin fellows, if not recommending it be funded this year and that it kind of be put on hold and we bring back for discussion in 2020, primarily because we're talking about doing some office space renovations. We have two new members in the county admin team, actually three with the CJ, with the criminal justice coordinator, but two new deputies. To bring in two new folks upstairs, I think is just going to be burdensome, to be honest. Yeah. I don't think the folks would get the full experience. I don't know if we'd be able to supervise them the best we could. And while I think the fellowship program is a great program, I think it may be best that we put it on pause just for 2019. Let's get our feet wet, get ourselves grounded, and bring it back for more discussion in 2020. So that's why I just wanted to make sure it was something that was approved that we are not going to implement this year, but want to bring it back in the future years. Stop DWI. Any questions on county admin before I go, or I can go right through it and we can come back.
Mark?
Just to be clear, the criminal justice coordinator position, that's a pretty big number. That includes the fringes, right?
Yes, it does, yes.
Okay, is there anything else in there?
There is. That also includes, I think, some travel, some training, some supplies. So it's not just personnel. It's a good point. It's the whole package.
Okay. Yeah. All right, just that's a big number.
Yeah.
And then the engineering for the capital planning, is
yes.
that Holt is doing some of that? Or is that
I would expect that's who we would use. Primarily that's because they do most of our architectural engineering work around our office space. If there's anything specific, it may deviate from that. We haven't really gotten to that absolute detail, but that's probably who we'd use, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Mike Sigler, then Dan, then Shauna.
I was just wondering if, since you're taking out $10,000 to give to the city parks in Ithaca, if you would consider maybe taking $15,000 out of your budget to put towards the parks in Lansing, Dryden, Groton, Newfield, Ulysses.
Okay.
Just putting that out there for you.
All right.
Good idea.
Mike, you'd have an opportunity to move that amendment to the budget if that's something you'd like to do.
Sure.
Dan?
The performance measurement project, I see you have that as year three of three. Aren't we in our first year right now?
I believe this is the second year. 2017 was the first year. This is the second year.
It's been going on for more than a year, you're saying, at this point?
Well, probably not. Okay. Technically, it was probably approved in 17. It probably started mid-17.
Okay.
But from a fiscal year perspective, this would be the second year.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Dan? Oh, I'm sorry. Shauna? We just had Dan.
I was wondering if the criminal justice coordinator, if that position was, if this was only a part of his salary, or if there was another part that was also the performance management.
It was, and I don't know all the history, but there was another OTR that is no longer because they absorbed those responsibilities. So there was a separate OTR for staffing some of the performance measurement program. And that those duties and responsibilities have been put into the criminal justice coordinator position. So that former OTR, portion of that OTR, is no longer continued. Bless
okay.
you.
And then my second question was the programs that you're proposing. Oh, never mind. Sorry.
Okay. Yes.
Just a follow-up about the parks. They did a first round of the study, if I understand correctly, and they are doing a second round specifically focused on possible governance modeling, and that is why we are continuing with our support of that. Is that correct?
That would be, that's my understanding of it.
Okay, thanks.
Henry?
Yes, she asked my question.
Yeah.
All right. Then you want to move on?
I can, sure. So Stop DWI. So Stop DWI is housed in county admin. It also, the coordinator reports to the county administrator, per charter. That's Michelle Lansing that serves as the coordinator. This is the budget. I'm going to get into some of the changes that have come with this budget. You can see there's been a decrease in expenses, a pretty significant decrease in expenses. There's been a decrease in revenues, and that's that's primarily due to the decrease in Stop DWI fines countywide. Full-time equivalence is two. It's actually one full-time equivalent with portions of two positions from the DA's office. Matt mentioned this earlier when he presented, so I'll give you a little bit more substance and background to this. Also, this used to be a budget that was self-funding or self-sustaining. So the funding for the staff and the programming was funded through the revenues generated through DWI fines and some other additional revenues, although primarily DWI fines. In this case, what's happened, so in this case, there's a one-time OTR. In 2009, we're proposing an evaluation of the program, the revenue trends, and how it fits in with the traffic safety grant program, which is a separate program. This, I think, is what's most important. As you can see, the blue line is where budget has been for the Stop DWI fines, which is the predominant revenue in this department. The orange is the actual, and for quite a few years, we've just come short. And the downward trend over the past 3 years is not uncommon across the state. When I checked with a lot of colleagues, they also found similar downward trends in DWI fines. I think that has to do with some of the changes to DWI laws, some of the ignition starters in the cars, and recovery of those fines and fees through the different magistrates and different courts. The point of this is that you've seen a deep decrease in the revenues, which is why we have limited the funding with those revenues to strictly the coordinator position and some of the activities from that the coordinator participates in. So these two DA portions of the two DA positions we're suggesting be funded with a one-time OTR where we evaluate the program, understand why the fines have decreased and what should be the course moving forward, and then bring that back to you in 2020. Should it be a target change? Probably a target change of the DA's budget, but also what's the future of the program? Traffic safety grant program is another program that the state offers for traffic safety grants. Used to be the old bunny money and buckle up New York, those types of things. That's all been consolidated into one program. So how can that be further supported by the Stop DWI coordinator? So it's kind of a real review and evaluation of the program. Lisa's been assigned that. She's already started to work on that a little bit. That's going to pull in the DA. It's going to pull in probation. It's going to pull in the Stop DWI coordinator. It's going to pull in the sheriff's office to kind of get together as an internal team to say what's going on with the program, where should we be going with it. Typically, revenues and fines and fees that were generated, there was a larger fund balance that was created. And what would happen is you'd be able to pull from that fund balance to fund Stop DWI details. So you would give mini grants to local law enforcement agencies, local PDs, or the sheriff's office to do Stop DWI grants, buckle up. That's a traffic safety grant. But also equipment for enforcement, such as license plate readers and different types of enforcement pieces of equipment that you would use for Stop DWI. Because the fund balance has been drained due to this, what you're having is your revenues weren't meeting what you budgeted. The fund balance will probably be gone this year, is that safe to say, Rick? It'll be gone this year, so you won't have any fund balance to pull from, which is why for the first time in the program we're actually funding it with some levy money here. Again, we'll evaluate it over the course of next year, probably make some recommended changes, and then see how we want to fund it moving forward.
Deborah.
So I was advised that this is a state-mandated program, It sounds to me, given that the fines have gone down pretty dramatically, that perhaps this has been a successful program and maybe we don't need it anymore.
That's one way to look at the numbers. One could say that because DWI fines have decreased, there is no more there's no more driving while under the influence of alcohol or substance. I don't know that that's the case. I'm sure people are still drinking and driving. The question of why are the fines decreasing gets into the rooted issue of are the courts seeking collection of those fines and fees? If so, are there the same amount of fines and fees and arrests going on? If not, why not? So I think that's where you're going to start to get into some of the detail as to why these fines are going down.
And Lisa's going to figure all of that out.
She's already down that path. She's had no problem. We've got to take care of her. But there's other elements to this too than just the DWI fines. So.
Ann?
I just wanted to counter what Deborah said, and just in the respect of if something's working, it doesn't mean we stop doing it. Like if your medication's working, it doesn't mean you stop taking it. So I just want to counterbalance that.
I can't help saying there's a lot of people on medication out there who would get DWI tickets. Let's put it that way. Martha.
If the fines are down and therefore the awards for the traffic stops are down, that means we're going to catch fewer people and the fines will be down and et cetera. So it's complicated, but I have always heard that there was a lot of that there were a lot of people not paying their fines, and that was the biggest issue. Is that, do we know?
I think that's going to be a portion of it. The question is why are the courts not requiring people pay the fines? Are they not being sought after? So that's going to be a discussion piece. You know, the enforcement element is going to play into. You're going to probably end up coming to the point that part of the reason enforcement may not be as frequent will depend on staffing of law enforcement agencies. So if you're down staffing on large, particularly some of the smaller, actually both large and small ones, they're not going to be doing as many special details because they won't have the staffing to do it. You know, a DWI stop itself could take 4 hours on a shift. If you work an 8-hour shift, you might get two in. That's assuming you were to have them on a regular basis. You know, so I mean, a lot of things go into this, and I think that's why it's probably time for a review of it and overhaul of it. It's understanding.
Okay, let's move on.
All right.
Oh, I'm sorry. Henry.
This is a state-mandated program. What are our options?
In terms of
analyzing everything, say we come up with, okay, the fines aren't, the people aren't for enforcing the fines or whatever.
Sure. So right here is, this is an interesting part. So you've got elements of the DA's office that are there to help process the paperwork, to help CDWI processing. The next question would come, if fines aren't being collected, are there actions we can take to collect fines? Let's say, for example, that just the fines aren't being issued or there aren't as many arrests. Why is that? There's also an education piece to stop DWI. What type of education are we doing and outreach are we doing in the schools with teenagers, with high schools, in the public in general? Is there partnerships with probation? Is there partnerships with treatment like Alcohol and Drug Council that we have? There is a contract we do have with them for advocacy and education. So it's not just an enforcement and collection piece to it. There is an education and outreach component. How involved you want this department to be in those activities may result in how large or how small the department is. Okay. So that will have a similar effect as to how much you fund it out of the levy versus the fines. Make sense?
Go ahead.
Veterans Agency. So this year, we are proposing the creation of the Veterans Service Agency. Under New York State law, Executive Law 357, all counties are required to have a Veterans Service Agency, and their director is required to be accredited under this law within 18 months as a Veterans Service Officer. And that accreditation comes through a series of trainings through the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. The primary purpose of the Veterans Agency is to be the local source for veterans to go to advocate and help them identify benefits, primarily veterans benefits, the GI Bill, for example, healthcare benefits. You have a variety of veterans. You have a variety of services and benefits they may or may not be entitled to, from housing to retirement to healthcare to education. And that's primarily the purpose of the Veterans Service Agency on the local level. It is an unfunded mandate. I will tell you that I think the state passed this past legislative session some increase in state aid, but nothing significant to help, quote unquote, offset the cost of veteran agencies. Probably no more than a few thousand dollars for most counties, but it is an unfunded mandate. To give you an example a little bit, just in our county alone, you have a little over 4,000 veterans. In total, they receive about $23 million worth of benefits that are distributed to those veterans throughout the county, roughly $11 million in compensation and pension benefits, $2.3 million education and vocation employments, probably primarily the GI Bill benefits, and about an almost $9.5 million worth of medical benefits that they receive. Tompkins County, as I mentioned, has a veteran population. This is as of 2017, of just a little over 4,000 veterans. Just to give you an understanding of the budget and how we came across some of these numbers, we took eight counties throughout the state that had anywhere between 3,900 and 43 veterans, so a comparable number of veteran population. Median population in those counties were a little bit smaller. They were around 60,000, although they were similar to us, what I would call rural. Median county veteran population was about 4,200. That's around ours. The median county budget for veterans was about 131,000, and roughly about 1.75 FTEs. They ranged from a half an FTE to five FTEs, you know, just to give you a variance there. What we proposed was putting $100,000 in program expense while we begin to evaluate what's the best way to provide this service to our veterans. Right now, Lisa has been working on and evaluating options anywhere ranging from hiring a staff member, which we think would be adequate to be able to support the claims or the amount of veteran activity we would have, to is there a possible partnership with the surrounding county or not. So we're looking at both those options. We have talked a little bit about housing, housing meaning real estate, of where we might put this person, because it's not going to fit in our office. And, you know, one of the discussion pieces that seems to be a natural fit might be having an office in the Office for the Aging. There seems to be a lot of overlap and synergy between our veterans and the Office for the Aging Services. So there's a possibility to that, particularly as our Korean and Vietnam vets begin to age more. So the recommended budget right now is $100,000. I would expect by the end of this year, early next year, we'll probably come back to you to amend the budget appropriately based on, you know, if you should adopt this, the course of action, how we want to implement it. I will add one other thing. Our district attorney talked about a veterans court. I would imagine this type of position would be intricately involved with individuals that might come across his desk with respect to veterans' needs, whether it be housing, whether it be mental health support, whether it be other medical benefits, those types of things. So I would imagine this type of position, the person filling this or person filling this role, would be a go-to and assistance of helping any veterans that come across the DA's desk.
Okay. Oh, Deborah?
So in the process of researching this, did you find out how many contiguous counties have veterans' offices? And I'd be also curious to know where the nearest VA medical facility is.
Yes. I believe all of our contiguous counties have a veterans' officer. The VA facility, like a VA hospital, I'm sure we can find that out. Yeah, I have a list of them. Oh, Syracuse.
Syracuse.
That makes sense. Yeah.
We have an outreach center on Route 13 up near NYSEG.
Okay. All right. Oh, Henry.
How long has it been a state mandate?
I don't know. I can tell you we were the last county or one of two counties not to have a veterans office. This came about I know it was something I noticed earlier on, but it came about when I received some calls from the second floor in the governor's office following up saying, this is a mandate, you don't have it, your veterans are going to adjacent counties, and those veterans' offices are simply saying, we're getting Tompkins County veterans. And when they followed up, basically what feedback was is you need to get a veterans' office up and running because it's a mandate, it's a requirement. I don't know when the law was started, but we can research when it was adopted.
I'm only one of two counties that doesn't have one?
Yes.
What's the other county?
I don't know.
Anna, then Ann, then Dan.
Just to confirm, this was in your recommended budget that puts us at the 1.65?
This was actually part of the financial goal. So when you guys adopted the financial goal, it was part of the target.
Right, but yes. This is not an OTR that puts us over the current 1.65 is my point.
Correct, it is not an OTR.
What is it?
And? It's part of the target.
And?
Is this something that we could possibly look at having somebody halftime to start and seeing what the need is here? I mean, but in I guess before I said that, I should have added that I have heard from a lot of my constituents that this is a need that people are, it's a hardship for a lot of the folks to have to drive to Syracuse or Bath to have to meet somebody about their benefits.
You could. I can tell you of those eight counties that I looked at, I think there might have been one that was a part-time veterans officer. It's obviously something you can consider. It would be hard, you know, hiring a part-time person has its challenges as well in terms of interest. So when I put this forward to you in April, May, when we did the budget retreat, I didn't anticipate it being part-time because I personally felt it would have been more than part-time work. But it's something, you know, obviously the legislature can amend the budget to do that. So.
Dan? I just want to say it's not as though we have ignored veterans. There used to be a state veterans officer here in Tompkins County who did this work. Apparently, we don't have that anymore. And I think that's when the state probably pulled that back, and they're going to say, well, you guys got to do it. And shift the money burden onto the local taxpayers here. We worked very hard with the state veterans officer when we brought the medical facility, which in the old Prudential building is where it is, on Route 13, which is still up and running. That might be somewhere to look for an office. I don't know for someone if we had something going here. But I sure don't want the impression going out there that we don't care about the veterans. I'm guessing the law that people are asking about probably was enacted like right after World War II, maybe in the 50s, something like that. And it is mentioned in our charter, but we have never had to have it because of the state officer. Martha?
I guess this isn't a question, but I feel like if we've, maybe it is, we support the VITA program, the tax program, tax advice program that AFCU runs. That doesn't bring in any money into county coffers, but they advertise it brings like something like $3 million or more into the county, puts it into people's hands. So this person with about 4,100 potential clients would be in a position of helping people access benefits they might not be aware of, might not be able to apply for. So this person facilitates that and theoretically would be helping to bring those resources into our economy in the same kind of way, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, my experience with veterans officers, particularly where you see a lot of impact, is when they're able to help with housing. And that, you know, that's a big barrier for veterans, particularly, you know, as your veterans come back from this most recent conflict, you know, their housing needs are different. They have challenges in adapting back into society, and having them assist with housing is usually the biggest hurdle and the most success they have. But They help with identifying benefits that they don't currently either have or don't have access to or don't know how to access.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Henry?
I also know that the woman who did the source of income discussion from Syracuse, or fair housing discussion, also talked about veterans who were discriminated against. Absolutely. In housing, and that, you know, so maybe we can vote on the human rights.
Well, I mean, it comes back to the housing needs, you know.
Right.
Like I said, veterans have, you know, veterans that are having challenges, they have special housing needs. You know, I've worked with a development group that focused just on veterans housing because there's certain needs that they have. And there's a federal voucher program that just veterans have access to. And sure enough, there's discrimination just as there is with Section 8 or any other voucher program.
Right.
Yeah. Anna?
I just wanted to add to that, the other big part of it is the mental health component, and my understanding is in some cases that this person or the office can act as case management to help them get connected to the proper mental health support that they need. And without that, there have been significant number of cases of people not knowing they have that support, not knowing where to find it, and having that be a huge barrier. So I just wanted to point out.
That's a big part of what the veterans courts were for, is being able to connect those mental health services.
Next.
Contingent fund is rather simple. We did a little research just to remind ourselves of what the baseline is, the target contingent fund. You've been in and around $900,000 on a regular basis for your baseline contingent fund, and that has met your needs for the past 4 or 5 years. We felt no need to increase that or decrease it. We did itemize out a little different this year. The one-time OTR, recommended OTR for jail board outs, is $300,000. Thought it was important to itemize out this OTR and any other OTRs in the future, should you want to add them to contingency or to contingent fund because they need more development, or you want it to come back to you at a later date once developed, similar to the Child Development Council this year, we would itemize them out under this contingent fund so it's very clear as to what these levels of contingency are for. In this case, we feel comfortable with the baseline, and we added the jail board outs as, again, year two of year three as part of the CGI report from last year. Tompkins Center for History and Culture, otherwise named as the Rich John Center. the RJ Center. So this is new to your budget this year. The project is up and running. The bids, as you know, were awarded, and they are well underway in building out and making the improvements with not... you know, it's seamless, and no problems have arisen so far. this is going to be an enterprise fund. Rick and I had, Kevin and I had a lot of discussions about how to account for this. It's an asset that you own. It's an asset in which it generates revenue to pay for its expenses. So the revenue is generated through the lease agreements and the lease payments of the tenants. The expenses are cleaning, electricity, utilities, insurance, et cetera, and as such, those revenues generated should pay for the expenses. So it should be a self-sustaining enterprise fund similar to the airport and similar to recycling materials and management that you heard from today from both Mike and Barb. This should not take any taxpayer money once up and running. So there is some detail broken out. It has to do with cleaning. It has to do with repair and maintenance, management, insurance. Just so you know, there will be, we'll probably be taking out separate insurance for the building. Because we're not going to be occupying it, we're not going to be operating it, it's going to have tenants in it. All the tenants will be required to have insurance naming us as an additionally insured in it. So we're still working through some of those logistics, but this should be an enterprise fund with no tax dollars, local taxpayer dollars towards it. So you'll have now three enterprise funds. Yes.
Martha.
So the enterprise fund will be sort of the building,
yes,
but not the History Center.
The History Center is a tenant.
Okay.
The History Center has its own budget, does its own thing, but it's a tenant. So in this instance, you are providing funding to the History Center for their operations. Ironically, they also provide you with rent which is the same amount of money you provide them. But, you know, they're their own entity. They're their own operating unit. All they do, your relationship through this avenue is simply as a tenant.
Okay, so for example, you used to say, you can't say we don't have any tax money into the History Center side, okay. Or might not be considering any tax money. Got it, okay. Thank you.
Yep. Capital budget. So the capital budget this year is a five-year capital budget. It's from 2019 to 2023. Capital investments total about $62.6 million. This is a spike over the prior 5 years, and that's primarily because of the terminal project, which is about $25 million of it. Enterprise funds is $38.6 million. Again, like I said, about $25 million of that is airport. Thank you. Thanks, Rick. General fund is about $24 million. Local dollar cost is about $22 million impact to that. So I'm going to go through some of the different capital projects. And what I did is I highlighted in bold and italics is the ones that are lined up, for next year. And really the two new projects are in facilities. We have next year, we're lined up for the DOH parking lot, as you might remember. Talked about doing parking lot renovations in the Department of Health. That was going to be complementary to any bus stop had it continued. It's not going to continue, but the parking lot, the base of the parking lot still needs some reconstruction work or partial reconstruction, so that's going to continue to move forward into next year. Cold storage building, this is a partnership between facilities and soil and water. They had a need to do for some additional storage. It's about a 6,000 square foot storage facility, split half and half. I'll get into a little bit more detail on that a little bit later. The old jail renovations, again, we talked a little bit about this at F&I, about a $2.4 million renovation to the old jail facility, and we can get a little bit into that. The other two are facility restoration, part of the facility restoration project. You have a pattern of doing 2 years on, 2 years off, that type of improvements. This is part of the capital plan, but they don't take place till 2021 and 2022. Highway, we have Ellis Hollow 4, not Ellis Hollow 3. That's to come in 2020. Ellis Hollow 4 is slotted for some basic resurfacing and some pavement work. I think Jeff talked a little bit about that. The other two, Ludlowville Road Bridge, as well as the road maintenance program. I should say that the road maintenance program is $9 million for the 5 years. It is $1.8 million a year. So that $1.8 million will be next year. That's road and bridge work. And then the following projects lined up for future years. IT, they've started or they will be starting this fall. HR, payroll, updates, finance is involved, HR is involved, my office is involved, Amy and/or Lisa have attended, and this is about updating your HR payroll system, leaving the tool TimeForce payroll system, and going electronic and digital with our HR records, which should be a big improvement over the current paper management system that they have. Again, a lot of this is cloud-based, so it's some upgrades in technology. Aquifer study program continues till 2022. I should say there's an error here on the natural infrastructure program. That should be till 2023, $1 million, not $800,000. So there's an error on our part. Aquifer study program, a little history, that is slotted to discontinue or end in 2022. It was, I believe, a 20-year program. Partners with the federal government as well as the municipalities to do aquifer study projects where we picked up a portion, feds picked up a portion, and the local municipalities picked up a portion. National Infrastructure Program is really kind of, I would say, a very progressive and proactive approach to stabilizing ecosystems around flooding and around the county, really getting off the ground, but a pretty progressive approach to environmental sustainability. I would also mention that those are all cash programs, meaning it's cash for capital. We don't bond for those. We contribute cash out of our capital fund. Airport. Mike stays busy up at the airport, as you can see, with a slew of projects. Nice thing about the airport projects, I will say, possibly with the exception of the terminal improvements, but probably not. All of these are federally funded, usually with no local tax dollars. So you see usually 90 to 95% of them are covered through FAA funding, and the remaining 5% or 10% is usually covered through PFCs, which is also federally funded, and fees that we get from the federal government that are charged on each passenger. Again, a series of equipment and improvements that are usually reviewed and approved through an FAA process or an FAA grant process. Two, for this year, next year, you've got some equipment. If you've been up there, you notice that they don't have small equipment. It's all pretty big, whether it's fire suppression apparatus or whether it's cleaning equipment to make sure the roadways of our runways are clear. The terminal improvement, you know, in case you weren't aware, we have about a $25 million project up there that's teed up. Still working feverishly at filling the gaps, but I venture to say, just due to sheer perseverance and annoyance, we'll probably hopefully get that money.
I don't understand the numbers.
They don't add up to.
Yes, this one does not add up.
Yeah. So it's not
no,
me.
That's an error there.
I think that's all the out years one, not the bold ones.
I'll have to go back and double check that. I apologize.
Okay.
That's not right.
Cut off.
Sorry about that. Solid waste. This is the total project over a four-year span. Improvements to the solid waste facility. You did one this year, phase one. You're going to be doing phases two and three, which are really improvements to the structure over there. A series of different improvements, anywhere from drainage to exhaust fans to sprinkler systems. Again, most of that is either going to be covered. It'll be covered through fees, through the fund or through fund balance that you have. New projects, again, briefly, just the cold storage building. I will tell you that John was able to get Senator O'Meara to contribute $60,000 towards the project, so net out of our pockets, about $140,000 for it. That was through some SAMS money, so that was good to hear. And they'll be splitting that 3,000 square feet each between Arell and John.
Do you mean we have $40,000, not
Again, another error there. Yes, that would be $60,000 grant, so it's a $140,000. Local cost is $140,000, not $160,000. Yep. Here. Yeah. Well. Okay. Facility renovations. We briefly had. Discussion of this at F&I. I believe we've set up some tours of the existing facility so you can see the real estate. Biggest, I think, challenge or biggest cost center around this is taking the basement and expanding the basement over the old boiler room. You get to see firsthand how big the boilers are. They have to be broken up and taken out in pieces and then expand that wall out to create a much larger conference room space than we have now, separated by a common folding wall with separate entrances into those separate conference rooms, expansion into some larger HR testing. Downstairs, there's a small room now where they do their civil service testing on computers. That would be expanded to provide more computers and more a greater testing area. Improved bathrooms downstairs, a shower downstairs for folks that that either work out or ride their bike in to work. Better amenities from that perspective. First floor renovations would really be taking the existing conference room and turning that into office space. It's prime space with prime light right now, and right now we have folks that are in areas that are not prime working conditions, so we're moving them into a better natural light area, which I think is better for them. If you remember, in the HR space, you have some stairs in the back from a raised floor. We did look at possibly lowering that, not cost very, very cost prohibitive. So we're going to do some ADA improvements to make it accessible with some lifts. We'll also probably leave that to not occupied space on a regular basis. just because if we can make use of other space that's more accessible, it'll be better for our employees and any customers that we have. And then there's third floor rearrangement and improvements to the third floor. One thing we did recently discuss is having possibly some additional consultants look at enhancing our ADA accessibilities to this building, because it's an older building. You have another set of eyes to improving ADA access, as well as maybe taking that a step further when we do any other renovations in any buildings as well.
Martha.
So there's a lot of work that's already in the old deal already happened. Your third floor seems to be, I don't know if it's finished, but it's
that was some makeshift movement of office space. Our facilities crew did a phenomenal job, basically shifting Autumn's desk over, enclosing Kevin enclosing Kevin on the east side of it, making space for Amy and Lisa to come in and having some privacy offices. And so that is done. It was low impact, no real movement other than taking a partition out. Facilities crew handled it, did a great job, and got it moved. So that'll be our temporary quarters.
So that's not part of the 2.3?
No, not at all. No, that was just we actually took the partitions. The cubicle that Kevin has was from the Tompkins Center when Tompkins Trust was in there. We took a few pieces of furniture. That was one of the things we confiscated from them, considering we paid $2 million for it. So we got a little bit of benefit out of that.
He's got a $2 million office.
Yeah, Kevin's got a $2 million office. And that's just the temporary quarters until the renovations take place.
So is that third floor suite, is that going to get redone?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's where I've heard you talking about Susie Cook's old office.
Yep. So Jonathan has some possible changes in his office area, maybe shifting some people around, moving Aaron into Susie's office, creating a separate office in the back, expanding Jonathan's to have a conference table for workspace. We've talked about also taking out the men's bathroom upstairs. If you're not familiar, the men's bathroom's on the third floor. Women's is on the second floor, single bathroom on the first floor, and two single bathrooms on the basement. We have more than enough fixtures if we were to consolidate them on the basement. With also several other single bathroom units. So we might take the bathroom on the third floor and turn it into a conference room, a smaller one. What you find are typically with the attorney, myself, and with HR, they have a tendency to have unplanned needs for private conference space, particularly in HR. So, for example, a lot of times when they're meeting with people about personnel issues, whether it's health insurance, retirement, could be discipline matters or otherwise. You don't always have time to schedule a conference room for that. So giving them one or two conference rooms that are just for their use, and as well as my office to have one or two. I mean, if you've been in my office, you know once we get about four people there, it gets really close and really, really tight. So being able to have a conference table where we could maybe fit five or six people in it without having to schedule it, same thing with Jonathan. That makes a better use of the space for our needs, because scheduling a conference room just isn't always practical from our perspective. Yeah. And that's still under, you know, work and review. I mean, still probably going to change some before, you know, if this is something we move forward with before we do it. Highway, this is a new project, Falls Road Bridge. This is over in Ulysses, right before the State Park, the overview of the falls, that bridge there. This right now is slotted for 2023. Jeff will probably submit this for New York Bridge program as well as the TIP.
Excuse me, Jason. Ann, did you have a question on the last thing?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I apologize.
Thank you. As far as the space, so as far as the ADA compliance, is that an outside agency?
We talked about having someone else take another look at it.
Okay. Yep. And I haven't asked you this before. I maybe brought it up originally when we thought about renovations to that building. Is there going to be somebody to look at it and say, hey, is there any way, if we're doing all this, is there any other energy efficiencies that can be done to the building?
Yes. So there is some work that was supposed to be done as part of the general renovations. I think there was a big electrical project that will then be packaged as part of this. And then any other, I know they just recently did some energy improvements not too long ago, but we will do a precursor review of everything if there's any major, what I would call low-hanging fruit on there for any energy efficiencies. If there's a large, you know, activity that comes up that really fits outside the scope of this, that may have to come back to the legislature for consideration, but we'll look at it for energy efficiencies as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Again, real quick, this will be slotted up. It's quite a few years out. It's new on the plan, but Jeff's going to try to get this under the Bridge New York program so we can get some funding for it. Again, I don't have to get...
Is that the Stonebridge?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, yeah. There's some improvements for it, yeah. Terminal project, again, big project this year, $25 million. A lot of improvements to the terminal and with that, some new flights and some new locations and destinations. So the capital plan, so this is cash flow. This is cash going out the door in millions over the course of those years. Not total project cost, but cash flow going out. For those specific projects, then enterprise fund projects, and then total. Okay, that's cash flow. Right here, this is just the projects slotted for 2019, what they look like with respect to cash and debt related to those projects in 2019. I'll preface that with two things. One, the spike in 2019 up to above $3 million includes the renovations to the old jail. Right now, we are suggesting that be cash for capital, not be bonded. Whether it be pulled from the capital fund balance or whether it be pulled from the general fund balance, we're suggesting right now it not, whoops, getting ahead of myself here, not be bonded. And I would imagine that over the course of next year, as we begin to review the capital plan and the capital policy, we will probably make some corrections or some recommendations as to projects later in the capital plan that might be more cash for capital versus debt. Cash for capital meaning not bonding. Rick and I have had some long discussions, and we'll continue to, about when it's appropriate to use fund balance rather than to bond things. Right now, you've done a lot of bonding, and we think that there may be some benefits to not bonding for some of the smaller projects.
Go ahead.
That's a lot of money.
Yes.
The capital plan cash flow 2019 to 23, the enterprise is 36
million.
That's...
I need your microphone, please, Deborah.
25 of that's the airport, so yes. I understand that. So do we have this other $19 million? Do we have a piggy bank somewhere?
I'll get to the later slides. That'll help calm you down as to where we're funding this and where it's coming from.
Thank you.
Yep, no, it's a good question because I think it really comes to speak to your capital policy, which is the 0.5% that you commit every year, and I'll show you how it meets these needs and how you can actually enhance some capital work. But it's a very good question because they're big dollar numbers, and you want to be sure you're covering all your points. Here is an example of what the 2019 projects would look like in addition to existing debt that's already out there. So the bottom portion is old debt. The top portion would be new debt. Okay. And you can see that spike again. I'm sorry, new debt and capital costs. That's new debt and new obligations. As you can see, that spike in 2019, that's due to the old jail.
Mike, do you mind if I also ask a question?
Yes, Anna, of course.
Thank you. So,
sorry, I'm watching the screen, too. So.
No, it's okay. I figured. So this includes both what is bonded. Of course, all of the old is bonded.
Mm-hmm.
But the new... You haven't decided of that estimate red area what you want as bonded and what you are going to recommend.
Right. So
it includes both.
So this is again the 5-year snapshot, the 2019 to 23. Those projects, we have made some estimates as to what we think is bonded and what would be cash for capital.
But that's not parceled in this. In this, it's just all of the debt, whether it's one or the other.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Yep. Cash and debt. Yep. So the capital levy, you right now have a policy. It's an adopted policy of 0.5% annual levy increase earmarked for capital. This year it goes up by $245,000. It's about $6.3 million you contribute towards the capital budget every year. Most of this pays for debt service. Some of it pays for cash, like we talk about cash allocation or cash for capital. The aquifer program and the natural infrastructure program are examples in where you use cash. There are going to be some other examples, like, for example, I think the cold storage building won't be bonded. It'll be used, you know, you'll pay for cash out of that. So that's where it'd be cash for capital, those types of projects. So in 2019, what we're recommending is that we do an update of that capital levy policy, as well as an update of the capital plan, and we review and spend some time looking at debt versus cash for capital for the projects that we know of. I don't know that you'll be able to create a hard policy. I think it's going to fluctuate. I think what you'll see is you're going to want to at least give strong consideration to continuing the contribution to the capital fund or capital budget with this policy, and I'll show you why in a second. But one of the things that we'll take into consideration with this is what type of capital projects do we foresee? You know, we've talked about sheriff's patrol building or improvements to thereof, a jail building, you know, improvements to or possibly new one. We've talked about downtown facilities or downtown offices. Do we renovate? Do we build? Do we buy? That type of thing. That's going to be part of the discussion. TCAT kind of lingers out there as to, is there going to be a need from that? You know, there's some other serious other capital projects that are kind of lingering there that I think will weigh into this discussion. So to answer your question, Deborah, you know, this is what would happen to your capital contribution if you continued the 0.5% levy increase every year. You're going to continue to increase your annual contribution to the capital budget. Based, it's supposed to be a different color, but it's a different color on here. I think it's the angle you're looking at. But the squiggly line is what would happen. That's where your debt and the capital projects that we have marked for debt now, that's where it falls if, on an annual basis, if you were to keep that that capital policy intact. So obviously you would meet all your needs right now. What I did was say, all right, well, what happens if we were to add some debt to the schedule? I've talked about three big buildings or three big, four big initiatives. Sheriff's building, jail, downtown facilities, right? Those are three big ones. TCAT, I'm probably missing another one or two in there. But those are big, big dollar items. So let's assume we take on $20 million of new debt. That's keeping the policy at 0.5%. That's taking on $20 million of new debt.
So when you have this line that steadily goes up,
yep.
That's enough money for debt service. It's not enough money to pay off the new debt.
In this, I've included what it would look like if you added more debt to your base, and it would be able to assist with taking on new debt for new capital projects.
But not paying principal.
Not paying it off. This is just debt service.
It would be your existing debt and additional debt. So it would be, my point is it would be able to, it would be able to manage additional debt above and beyond what you have now. So existing obligations and $20 million worth of new obligations.
Debt service includes principal payments.
Yes, principal.
Yeah, no, I understand that, but it's not like you could pay all your debt off at one time. It's not you saying you're taking $20 million in new debt. You're not saying that this upward line includes $20 million. You're just saying that we could comfortably service our an additional $20 million.
Yes, if you were to bond out $20 million worth of debt, those bonding out over, I believe, 20 years, your annual payments for that $20 million, in addition to your existing debt, would fit within that policy.
Martha.
So the calculations to figure out if that makes sense should obviously try to figure out where interest rates are going.
So when I put some of these assumptions together, I did a 20-year amortization. I probably did 3.5% to 4% interest. So it was, you know, a little higher than what it is now, but anticipating some increase. So I took some of those variables into consideration.
Okay.
Because when you're amortizing it out, I mean, if you amortize it over 30 years, you'd be under that. I mean, you'd be able to handle a little bit more capacity. But traditionally, we've been 20-year, around 20-year debt. Yeah. Less 2 years.
Less depending on the project.
Depending on the projects. I mean, if it was a new build, you would still be at 20 years, and probably even a renovation, you'd be at 20 years.
And we this trajectory includes things that are coming off of debt that we're finishing paying for.
Yes. It does.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lee mentioned the $20 million communications, you know, that we did 20 years ago,
yes.
18 years ago. Is that something that should be on the horizon, a sort of major redo of that?
Yes, and that also has some committed funding sources, too. But, yes, mm-hmm. That's all part of the capital plan revision. I also say there were probably two other items that you'd involve with the capital plan. They won't really have much significance on this, but it's something to consider. One would be probably in and around $1 million for IT upgrades and IT infrastructure, and another one would be replacing the election, voting machines at the Board of Elections. I know they've talked about it, and you're probably due. I think they're coming up on 10 years old. Those are small ticket items,
right.
You know, compared to the bigger piece, but they're things that we would incorporate in the capital plan.
Deborah, then Dan.
So, as I understand it, we are about to commit to the possibility, anyway, of taking on an additional $10 million in debt to pay for the airport, even though the airport would be paying that off. So is that included in your 20?
So I didn't identify what the 20 could be used for. I just used that as a whole placeholder. So this is where the question of debt versus cash for capital comes in, and your fund balance and your reserves and what available cash do you have available to you. In the case of the airport, let's say the worst case scenario is we don't get the additional $8.5 million or so. Okay, there's two ways of looking at that. One is the airport can probably manage, Mike says $3 million, I would want to be a little more conservative, probably $2 million worth of debt that could be paid for with PFCs, the charges. Then you might be down to about $6.5 million. There's a question as to whether or not you feel you want to bond it, whether or not you want to use some cash for capital, or whether you want to bond any of it. That's a discussion piece based on your fund balance and on some of your capital reserves that you have at the time.
How much is our fund balance?
In around 38 million, yeah. I mean, if you want to keep 20% of your general fund, which is about 36 million, that's a safe place to be. But, you know, it's a balancing act. It's a balancing act of what do you have on the horizon, and, you know, what portion do you want to use as cash, what portion do you want to pay as debt.
Dan?
And maintaining a safe fund balance at the same time.
Dan?
Jason, in the 2019 spike, the $2.4 million, if it were cash, then it would reduce. We wouldn't be paying it off over 10 or 20 years. If it were bonded, we would. Which did you use there? Which assumption?
This was a cash payment. This was a spike because it was an expense in that year. If you bonded it, it would level it out.
The line?
Yeah. Like if you bonded that $2.5 million,
the whole line, the whole bottom line would go up.
The spike would go down.
The spike would go down, but the whole 10-year payment or 20-year payment.
Technically, yeah, it would go up a little bit more. Yeah.
This is cash.
That spike is a cash payment. Yes.
Yeah. Martha again.
So the capital, the general fund balance is on page 21 of section 2. And so after the 2018-19 applications, in other words, so on the right-hand side, the bottom line is after all the ways that you're proposing using it in 2019, that shows we have 22.3% of our general fund is what our balance is. So our target for fund balance is 15% by policy. So you just kind of cavalierly said 20%. So we're even above the cavalierly said 20%.
Right.
So I understand that your and Rick's jobs are to really make sure we spend as little as we can, save as much as we can, et cetera. But there are opportunity costs if when this gets higher than it ought to be.
Yeah.
I would also add our job is also to keep you out of jail, so you don't spend it on things that you're not supposed to.
Okay.
This is a, you know, the fund balance discussion is a fluid discussion, right? So let's assume that after this budget process, there is more fund balance that might be used for one-time OTR, so on and so forth. So we would update this. Mm-hmm. Then it becomes a question of balancing. Balancing your safeguards as a municipality. So 20% is a good, healthy fund balance. The benefits to a healthy fund balance is a good bond rating, a secured bond rating. How you use fund balance is almost more important than where it is in the percentage scale. So let's say, for example, you go through a planning process and you say, we have a 22% fund balance. We're going to take a... Oops, sorry. We're going to make a conscious effort to bring that down to this number over a period of time based on a very thorough planned process. That's okay to do. You just have to know and weigh the balances. It's not as simple as saying, well, we're at 22, so let's get to 15. You benefit because you have a little bit more than that, and I would say when you go to use fund balance, whether it's through capital initiatives, whether it's through opportunity like a housing initiative, all of those things should be planned out, thought out, and then understood that this is a conscious effort to bring it from this to this because of these reasons. You know, that's really the safest way to approach that.
Or a conscious effort to be judicious about what we use it for, that they're truly sort of, I mean, capital is in a way, it's not one time because there's always another capital project. But, I mean, I think the benchmark has been sort of, it has to be 20 years, you know, last 20 years, at least an investment of 20 years or more. So, okay, I think it's an important policy discussion and sort of taking the temperature of what's the right level of it is more an art than a science, but it's important to look at the numbers together.
Yeah, no, when it comes time to have those discussions, you're going to want to know what you're balancing. You're making conscious decisions. Generally, gradual is better than drastic. And as long as they're, I mean, my experience with bond rating agencies is, you know, when you try to build reserves for that point in time where you can use those reserves, right? So when you use them, they drop. And that's a conscious decision on your part. And I think as long as you know that's planned, it's thorough, it's a conscious policy decision, and it makes sense, then I think you're in the safe hands of a bond rating agency. They're going to know that you went through a thorough process to do that. That's what I think is important.
Thank you. Yep.
Mike Sigler.
So what you're really saying is Martha's $3 million ask was really quite low. We could have gone.
No. I remember I told you our job is to keep you out of jail.
No. But our jail is going to be
but no bigger.
Probably the best for sure.
All right, folks, thank you all. Jason, thanks for that tutorial tonight.
Thank you. Yep.
On that. That was
good
very
thing we have
important, very well laid out. Okay, tomorrow night we're back for legislature. Our chair will be at the podium again, naturally.
Yes.
The night after that, we'll be here again at 7 o'clock for the budget forum. And that's the public's opportunity to speak to us about things, about the budget, before we've made decisions. And then starting the 9th, we will have our EBC voting meetings on the various proposals. If you have amendments, get them to Kevin McGuire.
Mike, Jason's doing a presentation of the budget on Wednesday night before
yes.
the public.
Yes.
Community forum.
Yes.
Before the public speaks, you're going to present?
At 7, I think.
Yes.
Yes. I'm ready.
Okay. Thank you all. Thank you, Kathy Covert. Thank you, Jim Blizzard. Thank you, Marsha Lynch. And our two new deputy administrators are here, Amy Hendricks and Lisa Holmes.